You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute or so past the hour of 6 p.m. here on the East Coast. And this is a special night of sorts. The 28th day of January 2008. It is, in its way, a night for celebration. A night for rejoicing. A night of happiness. It is, in fact, the night of George W. Bush's merciful last State of the Union speech. And I remember the first, and I will relish the last. Because in between time, it's been a long 8 years that has felt a lot like, what? The short bus road company version of Groundhog Day, with a profoundly impaired, inebriated understudy in the Bill Murray role. The Constitution of the United States says at Article 2, Section 3, speaking of the president, he shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union and recommend to their consideration such measures as he shall judge necessary and expedient. He may, on extraordinary occasions, convene both houses or either of them, and in case of disagreement between them, with respect to the time of adjournment, he may adjourn them to such time as he shall think proper. He shall receive ambassadors and other public ministers. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed and shall commission all the officers of the United States. You know, if you read Article 2, there's just not a lot of work for the President of the United States to do. And that was deliberate. Article 1 of the Constitution is the Congress. And it goes on and on and on and on with the stuff that Congress has to do. Article 2 comes along, and it says, you know, he needs to give a speech once a year. Lord, what a fundamental misunderstanding of the Constitution can do to a country. Now, to be fair, the judicial branch is an even shorter article than the executive. But yeah, from time to time, doesn't even say annually, from time to time, he's supposed to update the Congress on the State of the Union. And the State of the Union is not defined within the Constitution as being some sort of overtly political puff piece. So this evening, George W. Bush will be delivering three speeches. The unread, the unintelligible, and the unconscious. The unread one will be the official transcript, an attempt at soaring eloquence and a litany of belabored alliteration. This historic document will be larded with quotations by Plato, Thomas Aquinas, and John Stuart Mill, and Frederick Douglass, all of whom will personally endorse the president's tax policies. The official text is available in the Library of Congress and might be of interest only to Michael Beschloss and the speechwriter's family. The unintelligible will be the actual speech. Given the president's indifference to diction and overt hostility to coherence, the speech is going to sound like outtakes from the Beverly Hillbillies, the Jethro Bodine years. As is customary among members of Congress, the Republicans will applaud at an interval of 40 syllables, and the Democrats after 120. The unread speech will be the official transcript, an attempt at, as I said, soaring eloquence. In most circumstances, an audience could guess the topic by reading those subliminal slogans that have been plastered in the background whenever Dear Leader has spoken for the last 8 years. Their purpose, of course, to indoctrinate even when the VCR's on fast forward. Jingles pithily conveying a medley of noble sentiments like excellenting education and patrioting the economy. The president could be reciting the dirty version of Louie Louie, but the audience will only hear what it reads. Now, sadly, in the State of the Union speech, the audience doesn't have the advantage of explanatory wallpaper, what with that big flag hanging behind the president, and Dick Cheney looking over his shoulder, and Nancy Pelosi smiling away. We'll have to wait for after the speech for the professional media to tell us what we heard. Until then, there is some fun to be had with the State of the Union. Of course, many people are engaging in drinking games. Every time he says nuclear, you have to take a chug of your beer. If he refers to Iran's threat to world peace, you have to drink the whole beer. But there's also the fun of trying to guess who's going to be next to Laura Bush in the visitors gallery. It's pop-up figures that will be introduced during the speech as the personification of the president's themes. There will be at least one veteran of Operation Iraqi Liberation, and you can count on the White House to find the perfect one, a Hispanic creationist stockbroker who survived a third-term abortion. Then the Democrats will attempt a response, a pleasant enough nonentity will offer lukewarm platitudes while the public switches channels or goes to the restroom. If the Democrats want an audience, they do have appealing advocates. Imagine, Susan Sarandon asking the audience to stare at her chest while she discusses health care and the environment, or Julia Roberts defending a woman's right to choice in the event of being raped by Antonin Scalia. Yeah, that works. Then, after the speeches are over, all the professional media pundits will explain them for us, directly to you. You will be confronted with a panel of experts consisting of a shrill Republican, a pugnacious Republican congressman, a moderate Republican, that means someone who would prefer Eleanor Roosevelt to Mussolini, and Republican speechwriter Peggy Noonan. Any Democratic voice would presumably be the liberal media moderator. No one, however, will acknowledge the Democratic speech. However, you will learn that the president's speech was a masterful display of statesmanship and eloquence. As usual, with a straight face, that must require Botox. Noonan, will proclaim that the president was Churchillian. Well, you know, for that matter, if you remember what the pundits said last year, you don't even have to listen now. You know, sometimes, I got to tell you, getting sent stuff in advance of the program by Eugene Finnerman is almost, well, it is. It's very much. It is exactly like having a professional writer. Nobody better on the internets or elsewhere than Eugene Finnerman. So we can't help but probably be a little bit distracted by the State of the Onion this evening. I am told by a quick trip over to our dear friends at WD-40 that the dear leader will threaten vetoes in an attempt to cut out pork barrel spending by a profligate Congress. So $19 billion in congressional earmarks turn out to be bad. $70 billion in Iraq earmarks. It's of critical necessity to help take this fledgling Iraqi democracy forward. Wally over at WD40.com, that's D-U-B-Y-A, the letter D, the numeral 4, the numeral 0, .com, WD40.com. Wally did a little number crunching. $70 billion, and, you know, he prints it out in numbers. Look at all those zeros. Man, America hasn't seen so many zeros since Pearl Harbor. But he figured it out. A little bit of long division, a little bit of gazettas, a little carry the two, a little rounding. And what you come up with is $233.33 for every man, woman, and child in America to continue the Iraqi-pation. $233.33 for every man, woman, and child in America to throw down a rat hole. So I saw that coming from Wally over there at WD40.com. And a little light bulb went off in my head. And I did some quick subtraction. What that means is that when George Bush sends you your $300 economic stimulus check, what he's doing is doing a deal with you. I mean, this is old school. He's giving you $300 for you to give him back $233.33 of it, leaving you with a net gain of $66.66. $666. And an extra six for good measure. He's not just any garden variety Antichrist. He can throw an extra six in there. That just sort of, scary stuff. But really, I mean, isn't that how it works out? Everybody's going to get $300. And then of the $300 you get, the giveaway that we're going to put out there to continue the Iraq war, billing now at approximately $1.6 trillion and counting, climbing, leaves you with a windfall profit of $66.66. Wonder how the rapture-ready folks feel about that. You suppose the fundamentalist Christians will run right out and cash their check, not knowing that what they're actually getting is $66.66? What if they have to get a hand stamp going through the security to get into the bank to get their net gain of $66.66? Oh, they won't be rapturing through the roof of their cars, whether they're naked or not. Somebody's wearing the mark of the beast. But that's where we are tonight. Assumptions have been made in Washington, D.C., primarily by the administration of George W. Bush and the Repig-Lickin' Party in general, that the American people are so hopelessly gall-dang stupid that we won't notice that while they jack up a bill on us for $233.33 per person and give us, give, it's your money, $300, that we won't notice we've been had. And you know what? Honest people, dishonest people won't realize they've been had. They'll feel like they're coming out ahead of the game. But honest folk, remember, you can't cheat an honest man. Honest folk will realize that they have just been unwittingly, well, involuntarily brought into a very high-stakes game of three-card Monte. Welcome to the Midway. You're so not going to love it. So let's go to the phones. Let's start this discussion this evening on the State of the Union. I need a keeper. That was the wrong knob. Let's start this discussion at the phones. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hey,
Susan, what's up?
Well, I'm one of those people that I will not be watching the State of the Union, because I have a tendency to end up totally voiceless after screaming imprecations. So what I'm going to do is I'll take the transcript and then I will dissect it line by line and put it
on. But see, you miss it. When you do that, Susan, you miss all the mispronunciation fun. And you miss getting
after
to see the woman at the...
years, it's not fun anymore.
I predict this year we get a woman in full burqa who has been... who has been cured of breast cancer in Dubai in the audience.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised. Nothing surprises me.
But you still can't quite bear to watch it.
No. I will just go berserk. I'll end up putting something through the TV tube, and I can't afford to replace the TV set.
This is why you buy the 5-gallon bucket of industrial strength glue. You put a box fan behind it facing you and let it blow the fumes right at you, Susan. And everything is fun.
Stoned at the same time, huh?
Exactly. That's the purpose for all the drinking games, but I understand you can't. So you gotta find an alternative. Huffing gas, sniffing glue, spraying Pam in a baggie. It all works.
Yeah. Never thought of that. I'll have to think about trying that.
Every time he says nuclear, you have to huff a little bit more model glue.
Yeah. A little bit more super glue. I haven't seen about super glue ever since my son glued his sister's eye shut with it.
That's probably a story for another day.
Yeah.
It's the same reason that I said the other night that if there's a glue gun in three counties, my children will find a way to hot glue themselves together.
Oh, yeah. I can totally relate with that. Like I said, my son glued his sister's eye shut.
The fun part of that, though, is that your daughter cooperated.
Well, actually, no, she didn't.
Oh, she was asleep?
That was the interesting part.
She was asleep?
She just did it. Nope, she was wide awake.
Parenthood, such a joy.
I ain't it, though. Anyway, did you hear? Okay, Kennedy endorsed Obama.
Yes, I did.
Okay, that's neither here nor there. Did you see the thing from Media Matters? Apparently, the right wing has jumped all over that endorsement and claimed that, this is the hate speech wing coming in to support Obama.
Huh?
What?
I'm telling you, the glue comes in handy if you're going to do that kind of stuff. You got to at least huff a gallon of gas if you're going to go around reading right-wing hate.
I looked at that and I almost fell off the chair. They didn't give any examples. They just came right out and flat out lied on Fox. And I'm going, wow, these people were stupid. But they came right out and said, here's the hate wing of the left wing weighing in on Obama's side. I'm going, Kennedy?
I know. Of course, I get these right-wing emails, Susan, and I see things. Let me see if I can find it. The latest one I got was that they have known, this particular right-wing website has known for months that Ted Kennedy would come out and endorse Barack Obama. Because, as they say, well, Senator Ted Kennedy's endorsement of Barack Obama for the Democratic presidential nomination should come as no surprise to readers of the Insider Report, which has disclosed Kennedy's membership in the so-called Gang of Four Hillary Clinton haters. The four, Kennedy, John Kerry, Howard Dean, and Al Gore, have pledged to stop Hillary from getting the nomination, and each has his own reason for detesting Clinton. It's just like Clue. Why, it was John Kerry in the conservatory with the rope.
Gee, I thought it was a lead pipe.
No, that's Ted Kennedy in the billiard room.
Oh, okay. Okay. Who has the gun? God, this is just so sick. I mean, it's just, and it's an early indication of, oh, crap, what they're going to dump on that.
It's Dr. Dean in the kitchen with the knife, by the way.
Oh, okay. Can you imagine the look? Oh, I don't want, this is going to get ugly. This is going to get really ugly.
So, there you go. But that, they well, Susan, I've been thinking a lot about this because and you see it too, because you go wandering around the blogs. There is so much internecine squabbling going on among Democrats right now that it's pathetic. And because
yeah, I keep saying two reasons, two words to convince anybody to vote Democratic if they're at all progressive.
Supreme Court. Precisely.
Yeah. I don't care if they've got two heads and they're purple pecking on it. If they're a Democrat, I'm voting for them in the general election. I'll vote the way I feel in the primary.
Yeah.
But damn it, I am not going to let the Supreme Court go the way of the Justice Department, the way the EPA, the way the rest of the goddamn government. Pardon my friend.
Susan, that's the only, it's already gone that way.
Yeah.
What is disturbing? We've got Roberts and Alito for 40 more years.
Yeah.
We have Scalia and Thomas and probably Kennedy for 20 more years.
Yeah.
That means that the next appointee will be part of a generational shift in the court. If that next appointee is a right-winger, anybody even approaching Roberts or Alito or Scalia or Thomas, we're done.
Stick a spoon in a stick fork in a...
I was kind of geeky over the weekend, and I went in search of some of that marvelous documentary that Ken Burns did on the Civil War, because I'm a Civil War geek.
Oh, yeah, I love that. Oh, I love that.
And, you know, there was a brief mention in that documentary of the Dred Scott decision.
Yeah.
As issued by Justice Roger Taney of the United States Supreme Court, who was an originalist, and he was everything that the Republican Supreme Court would aspire to be now, and he held that, you know, a dark-skinned human being could not possibly be anything but property. And it's not a concise analysis of the Dred Scott decision, but close enough for government work. And when you think about it, Susan, how many years now has the Dred Scott decision been screwing up America?
How many years has that decision echoed and re-echoed? How much blood has soaked into the ground?
Dred Scott, in its way, had as progeny things like Plessy versus Ferguson, that set up separate but equal accommodations.
It's
Dred Scott, in its way,
as it's
has...
watch riots.
Well, Dred Scott, even as recently as last year, when Scalia and Thomas and Roberts and Alito and Kennedy got together to undo Brown versus Board of Education, as they did,
they
were acting as the progeny of the Dred Scott decision.
Yeah.
So as we consider things like that, Dred Scott, Plessy versus Ferguson, the, the old anti-union cases, the union-busting cases, all of those hateful pieces of crap that came out of the Supreme Court, as we consider those things, we must remember that they reverberate for years and years and years and years and years.
Yeah, they echo down the corridors of time, and you just...
If John McCain, if Insane McCain or Willard Ratman Romney or radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huckabee or Giuliani, if any of those four get an opportunity to appoint even one Supreme Court justice, the decisions rendered by the Supreme Court of the United States of America will reverberate hatefully and painfully and in blood and agony for 100 years or more in the future of the United States.
And it's going to literally kill West Virginia. And I mean that in the most literal sense.
It's going to kill the whole country.
Yeah, I know, but it will hit first. The hammer will fall first in West Virginia.
How do you see that?
Think about it.
How do you see that?
King Cole.
King Cole's getting away with it already.
Yeah, I know, but you're using the courts to try and fight them. Now, you're starting to have some success. Those cases will eventually be appealed to the Supreme Court.
Usually they're killed at the level of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah, I know, but the sooner or later you're liable to get a member of the Fourth who is going to skip it and allow it to go past the Fourth Circuit, in which case it'll go up to the Supreme Court. And then, that's when the hammer falls. Because the Supreme Court sets precedent.
As much as I am involved in that issue, mountaintop removal, and I've got an update on what's going on here near the studios this evening, as much as I'm an advocate and a fighter or a part of that battle, I have to look at other things, Susan.
Mm-hmm.
It is the incessant drumbeat of the right wing that is opposed to a man or a woman's right to engage in the use of birth control. Men don't think about it, but men are as under attack as women in this particular social cultural battle. Because one has to attack the right to birth control in order to outlaw abortion.
And, you know, men don't honestly think about the a lot of guys don't think about the consequences. Okay, fine. You say birth control, you don't need it. Okay. Go look up the success rates on condoms.
It applies even to condoms.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but a condom can be hidden more successfully. You don't need a prescription for condoms unless they decide to put them on the prescription list, in which case...
That's what I'm getting at. In order to overturn Roe versus Wade, you have to overturn the access of all of America to contraception of any form.
Then the term shotgun marriage is going to come right back into the lexicon, and then... the guys will sit up and take notice.
A day late and a dollar short in typical guy fashion.
And unfortunately, it's going to be the women who will pay and pay and pay and pay, because if they aren't paying by being stuck in a dead-end life with too many babies too soon and too little money, is going to be literally dead from back alley abortions. And I'm old enough to have seen the results of a few of them.
So, as we watch tonight, as we watch dear leader basically piss and moan,
mm-hmm.
Well, some of us will. You'll read the transcript. I understand. I really, really do understand. It is worth bearing in mind that we can take a little bit of a breath, a little bit of a sigh of relief, Susan, because this is the last time we ever have to listen to that pig-eyed, jug-eared, vile, hateful, dirt-ignorant, little, filthy lout do this.
We hope.
No, it's the last time we ever have to see him do it. I'm convinced of it. He'll leave in January. He'll leave.
He has to leave.
He has to leave. His own party would run him out if he refused to leave. Because he's killing them.
Yeah, well, martial law bans all parties.
No, it doesn't. No, it's just, but his own party would is sick of him. But he will go away, and we don't have to hear this anymore.
Oh, thank you, God.
Precisely. Flying Spaghetti Monster, yes. Here's your prayers.
Yes. Blessed be his newly appendage. I do think that if there is ever a case of divine intervention, when the Republican convention starts up, somebody up there, it's a great place to put a nice big greasy spot. And no, Agent Fred, this isn't a threat. This is just a profound prayer for divine intervention. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I understand. Susan, have a wonderful night.
You too. Love that.
Yours probably will be more wonderful than mine because I'm actually going to watch this misery. At least until Tony Bourdain comes on at 10.
Well, then, in which case, I, in my official capacity as News Ninja, I hereby prescribe immediately afterwards 2 good stiff shots.
You know, I've never been one to scoff at doctor's orders. Thanks, Susan.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. And on we go. Hi, who have I got?
Hello?
Hey, Juanita.
Oh, I got you.
I got you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a few things, and I'm not going to take a lot of your time.
You take all the time you need.
Well, I've been wanting to ask you this since last night, but I'll ask it on air. What about this Dennis Kucinich? Is he going to get to do what he wanted to do? About the impeaching Bush.
That was supposed to have been introduced today, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I haven't seen any news as to whether or not he did.
Well, what I saw, they weren't on there very long. It was mostly about naming a post office after a soldier that got blown up.
Glad to see Congress doing taking care of the serious mm-hmm. business of the nation, sure.
But I didn't know if he was supposed to do it. I heard that he got on the other day on Wednesday and the Republicans give him heck and he said, well, withdraw what he said so he could just put the whole thing in there, you know, today. But, I would love to see that. I just wondered if they were really going to let him do that.
I don't know. I followed other things today and not so much that. Shame on me.
Well, I was trying to find it and I didn't really. I don't know. Of course, I could have missed it. And another thing I wanted to ask you about was Obama. Did you watch his speech after he won Carolina?
The victory speech? Yes, I did.
I had heard him speak on the last speech before then, but I heard him read it. Heard him, you know, and I was very impressed about his speech on hope that he made on Martin Luther King's birthday, I guess. But this one was kind of, he really thinged Hillary in a very unique way, I thought, didn't you?
The whole South Carolina thing was quite interesting, Juanita, because the whole South Carolina thing was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Just in because the numbers came out once again so far from what they were expected to be.
Well, his speech, and I thought, boy, he's really, he's not going to take nothing off of anybody. But I was kind of concerned because he kept saying, nothing's going to be easy, and it's going to take time, and there were, you know, interspersed in all that. I just kind of had this strange feeling about it. That's what I wanted to say.
Okay. On the other hand, it is quite interesting that if you total up, you take Barack Obama's South Carolina vote total, and then you take the vote totals for the two leading vote getters for the Republican Party primary.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama drew more votes by himself.
Yeah.
Than both Huckabee and McCain combined. That's a good sign in a place like South Carolina.
I know it's a good sign. I'm just concerned about what we're going to get because I don't know. I guess wavers sometime, you know.
I have a very clear list, a very clear sense of priority. I still prefer John Edwards to Barack Obama, and I prefer Barack Obama to Hillary Clinton. But I prefer Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John Edwards, and quite possibly Quisp and Quake, Count Chocula, and Frankenberry all to anybody that the Republicans can put into the office, because this goes back to the discussion that I was having with Susan about the Supreme Court. This matters profoundly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for nothing else but that. If nothing else but that. I'm all for all of them, like you said, but every once in a while I get this strange feeling. And maybe it's just, maybe I'm picking up my wrong vibe somewhere. I don't know.
Can you put some meat on the bones, Juanita? What about the feeling of strange?
We can do all these changes, but it's going to take a lot of time. It's going to, you know, in other words, it wasn't like, you know, now, you've got, Edwards promising to go in there and doing something. And I know that presidents can't do everything, but they can do some things right off the bat. That's just what I heard a lot of, you know, like it's going to be hard. It's going to take a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of cooperation from the other side. And I don't know.
Barack Obama, if I read Barack Obama correctly, he genuinely believes that there can be an American rapprochement between the right and the left. I don't know that I agree with him on that.
Yeah, that's one thing with me, because our party has just kowtowed to Bush this whole time. And you wouldn't have thought after they got control that they would have done it so much, but they're still doing it. It just looks like to me, and I know that if they hadn't have got in, it would be much worse. I'm sure of that. That's what I'm concerned about, is does he realize that these people, they're master manipulators? Will he fall under their spell? Will he trust the wrong people? I guess that's what I'm trying to say. It's not him. It's who's he going to trust, you know?
Does that make any sense? Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, you've got a decision to make tomorrow. Technically, you can go and vote in the Florida primary, right?
Yeah, and I did find out if you're independent, you can only vote on the issues. You can't vote on a candidate. You have to stick to your party. Well, what's funny is the Republicans are calling it a Republican primary, and it's not just Republican primary.
There's a Republican primary and a Democratic primary.
Yeah, but they're not saying that.
That's probably because of the wrangling that's taken place inside the Democratic National Committee between states like the DNC and Florida and Michigan, where both states ran up their primaries in order to try to get into the fight, into the mix a little bit earlier, and the DNC stopped them in their tracks and said, "We're not going to seat your delegates at the convention."
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got some issues that I'll have to vote on, and referendums or whatever you call them.
I'm getting a message right now interpreting what your misgivings are in listening to Barack Obama. The message, Juanita, is she is hearing him be a shallow, waffling, slick-talking, fancy, empty-suit preacher man.
Not really, no. I don't know what I'm... I don't think I'm ready to say what I really mean. But that's pretty good. Okay, well, the other thing I wanted to talk about is totally different. It concerns coal. I got to where I love to watch these things on educational TV.
Mm-hmm.
Different ones where people are giving, what you call it? It's not discourses, but you know what I'm talking about?
I understand, yes.
What is that called? I know what it is. I can't think of it. But anyway, have you heard of the book called Global Warming, A Nation Under Siege?
No, I have not.
By Edward Masuria. Okay. It's about coal, and he tells how we need to get rid of it, the use of it. And it was so interesting, Bob. It was really good, and I wish you could interview this guy, because he brings out that he said, like, if your child gets away from you and they run and they're in the roads, that you're not going to wait to see if there's a car coming. You're going to go and get them whether there's a car coming or not.
Sure.
And he said the car is coming in our, and we're in the road. And he tells how it can be done. You can start off with all the businesses, the new businesses, and even new homes, being built with alternative energy. And he says there's no need for nuclear, if I understood him right. He even said, places like, isn't it Oregon where it's cloudy a lot? And he showed the measures of the sun. You can even use the sun there, even though it's cloudy a lot. You still have a lot of energy there. And places like Florida and California, sky's the limit, because we've got plenty of sun.
Sure.
And it is really interesting the way he does it, the way he spells it out. He said what it is, you have to do away with the demand for coal. And I thought that would really interest you.
Shoot me a link with the guy's name on it, would you please?
Sure.
And I'll see what I can come up with.
Yeah, it's really good. He's really a good speaker, and he does it very simplistic, and he's worked in it. And he's talking about how even the oil and all we're just taking now. We've gone too far, We're just oil and the coal, we're just gone too far. We're just used it up, But I had one thing else I'm going to tell you. I had a very interesting conversation with my right-wing friend today. This is the first time we really had a conversation that was civil about politics. And she doesn't like any of the Republicans at all.
Not conservative enough, let me guess.
No, she's of course, I don't think she's too crazy about the Democrats, but I think she had a little bit better to say. But she says, we've just got nobody. And I went over them and I said, well, in Florida, McCain is ahead and Romney's next. And she said, yeah, he's just wishy-washy. And I know she doesn't like McCain. And what's his face? From New York is third, and she...
But she's got to like radical fundamentalist cleric Mike Huckabee.
Oh, she don't like him either. Because I said, Mike Huckabee can fool you and make you think he's really got your best interest at heart, but I said, he's got some very strange beliefs. She said, you better believe it. So...
Is she sitting it out?
Huh?
Is she going to sit it out?
She hasn't said. I don't know. She might. Who knows? You never know. But,
That sort of speaks, Juanita, to what Obama is getting at, I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere, I don't know if it's a gut feeling he has or whether he's got some internal polling data on American attitudes, but he is going to try this reach out and be friends thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we definitely need healing, for sure. But, with the news people, whatever you want to call them.
The professional journalists.
We've got, that's as bad as the government. And I think the government is, a lot of that is their fault. I really do.
The Republican Party, Juanita, has done everything in its power to start everything short of a civil war in this country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like I said, I geeked up over the weekend and went back and rewatched Ken Burns' The Civil War.
Uh-huh.
And the same words that were coming out of the South prior to the Civil War about the nature of government are virtually identical to what is being said by the modern Republican Party.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, it's not even nuanced. It's the same message. I have said time and time and time again that the Republican Party has never had an original idea in its life.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true. The business about states' rights, the business about not trusting government, the business, it's all a rehash. And they only get away with it because there are so very, very many Americans, Juanita, who don't know squat about our own history.
A lot of people still believe that Obama is a Muslim.
Oh, I know.
People still believe that.
I know.
And then, like, on your previous show, the previous show with Mark Levine, you know, that guy was saying about Hillary. You wonder, what has the woman done that makes people hate her so?
She breathes.
This is a
function of the success, Juanita, of the anti-Hillary Clinton machine that has been a building since January 1st, 1992.
Well, you have people, the minute they came on the scene, and the first I heard about them was when they were all starting, he was running for president the first time. I never heard of the guy. And where I was working was a young college boy was there, and he was in the Young Democrats. And he was involved with all of them, and he was the one that brought out about Clinton. He kept saying, this is the guy you should vote for. And I said, why should I? You know, I'm just being facetious and giving him a little hard time. But he was around them, all of them, quite a bit. That was when about eight of them were running. Remember Tsongas? Remember him?
Oh, sure. Paul Tsongas.
Yeah.
And yeah, he won New Hampshire in 1992, Al Gore, and Clinton came in second.
And there were a bunch of them running, a bunch of Democrats running then. And this guy, he was a young Democrat. And of course, I could tell him a lot of things. You know, he just ate it up. He just loved to hear some of the things that I knew. And anyway, oh yeah, Jerry Brown was running.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of them.
I remember when they smeared Jerry Brown by calling him Governor Moonbeam.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that too. But I think we got some pretty good people.
We've got a lot of good. We've got a lot of good people.
Yes.
And again, I believe that the divisiveness and the downright crankiness that we're seeing inside Democratic partisan circles is a function of the aching need that every Democrat feels to start fixing America. Because that's our job. It's our job, Juanita. A Republican comes in for 8 years.
Every time we turn around.
A Republican comes in for 8 years and then maybe has a vice president elected, and that makes it 12. That was the case with Reagan. 8 years of Reagan, 12 years of H.W. Bush.
Right.
And you get a Democrat in, and Democrats around the country roll their sleeves up and say, okay, they've made a wreck of things. Now it's time for us to start fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're anxious to do that. We are anxious to start righting this ship. We are anxious to get down into the holds and start pumping out the filthy bilge of 8 years of George W. Bush. We can't wait for it.
And, you know, I can't. You know, one thing that I think of the people, you know, when they went into when we invaded Afghanistan, they were going to fix that country up and all. And I think how wonderful it would have been if the Democrats were in charge. They would have done it. They would have fixed the country up.
The country was darn near well fixed when Bill Clinton left. I mean, what?
How many trillion dollars
in surplus? $2-4 trillion surplus?
Yeah.
An opportunity to shore up Social Security for the next 100 years?
Right. But I'm talking about Afghanistan. If we had have invaded, if our party had have been the ones in charge, we would have fixed that country up like they said they were going to do. They fixed them up all right, and then they turn around and...
I don't think under any set of circumstances... One, I don't think 9/11 would have happened if Al Gore would have allowed his rightful place in the White House. Two, had 9/11 happened on Al Gore's watch, I don't believe that he would have swatted a fly with a sledgehammer.
Right.
So I don't think there's any way that you can work that scenario where Al Gore is in the White House and we wind up in Iraq. Winding up in Iraq took a level of stupidity
and evil that
can only be filled out by somebody like a member of the Bush family.
Mm-hmm. That is just completely wrong, absolutely wrong.
And let me take it another step further. Had John McCain won the nomination in 2000, the Republican nomination, and he became President of the United States in 2000, I don't think we would have wound up in Iraq.
Yeah.
No, because Iraq was a stage-managed creation of the Bush cabal. And it took a moron like George Bush to take the bait. Can you imagine how bin Laden must surely have clapped his bony little hands and giggled and sung little happy songs in his cave when the bomb started falling on Iraq?
Every step of the way, he has done exactly what they wanted him to.
Because bin Laden tried and tried and tried all during the Clinton administration to get the Clinton administration to go for full-scale war in Iraq, and Bill Clinton would not take the bait. Now, he flew around in the no-fly zones, and some artillery and a little bombing here and there, mm-hmm. and, you know, slaughter a few civilians here or there. And during the Clinton administration, yes, something on the order of 500,000 to 1 million children died for want of adequate drinking water, adequate infrastructure, medicine, and food. Absolutely happened. But Bill Clinton never took the bait of starting a war with Iraq. But George Bush got into office, and for Osama bin Laden, it was like taking falafel from a baby, getting him to start a war
yeah.
with people who had never done anything to us.
I think you're absolutely right. I totally agree. I said that. You know, they're making fools of us. They're had to laugh at us. We're the laughing stock of the world, probably.
This is the last time that the United States has to sit and listen to George W. Bush make a mm-hmm. fool of our nation.
Well, I'm going to try to listen to him. I don't know how much I can take, but I'm going to try to.
Well, good luck.
I don't know if I'll make no way, but I'm going to try.
I recommend screaming as needed. Thank you, Juanita, and you have a wonderful night.
Okay, and I'll get that to you, that name of that guy, because I don't think you'd be sorry. I think that he really brings a lot of the things you're talking about out.
Well, I look forward to finding out more. Juanita, have
yeah.
a great evening, and I hope you go out and vote tomorrow down there.
Take care.
All right, bye-bye. Just getting this in from Brandon up in Brooklyn. I just heard what you said about vote count totals for the top Democratic candidates versus all the Repig candidates. I noticed that in all the primaries where vote totals were reported, in every primary so far, the top two Democratic candidates are getting more popular votes than the top four Repig candidates. It's an early forecast to me of a high voter turnout this fall, as we know what is, in my opinion, to be a historical truth in elections. When there's a high vote turnout, Democrats win. When voters stay away from the polls, it favors the Repigs. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. You should see what the ends of my shoes look like, Brandon, from the crossing of the toes, too. I'm crossing fingers, I'm crossing toes, I'm standing here wrapping my elbows together like some sort of contortionist. Because we are getting to a point where we're going to have to circle the wagons. After February the 5th and Super Tuesday, it is very likely that we will be pretty well assured, no matter who your candidate is, pretty well assured of who the Democratic nominee is going to be. At that point in time, it becomes incredibly necessary for us to rally. Or for us to at least begin holding our noses. Some candidates inspire in me the urge to pinch my nose more tightly. Must be Monday. More tightly closed than others. But it is an utter necessity. And I hope, if you've listened to this program for any length of time at all, I hope, dear Jesus, I hope that you understand I am no party flack and no party hack. And I'm not going to sit here and rah-rah some candidate unless I really feel like the rah-rahing is called for. But by the same token, when it comes down to a head-to-head between Hillary Clinton and John McCain or Romney or, you know, any of the freaks, I'm going to tell you the honest truth, and that is she will be miles ahead of any one of them. The same thing applies to Obama, and God knows the same thing would apply to John Edwards. Another email rolls in. Obama's general tone, wanting badly to be happy with Obama should he be elected and not just a triangulating weasel. I offer this on the squishiness of his positions. The man realizes it is radical enough that he, an African American, is emphatically asking for Americans to vote and vote for him. He might be simply avoiding being perceived as a radical African American, being radical enough to ask for the votes of America. And that makes significant good sense to me. So I sincerely hope that we can find a way to unify. And I know maybe you think that I overemphasize the Supreme Court. I hope that I can convince you that I'm not overemphasizing it. The The president who appoints the next couple of Supreme Court justices will either put the final nails in the coffin of the republic, and that's what happens if you stay home and you don't vote for the Democratic nominee, or we will have a chance to stave off the likes of Roberts, Alito, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy. Because those five can't live forever. It appears to be the case that the president, a Democratic president or a Republican president, will get to replace John Paul Stevens. After that, well, who's next? And that's the tough call. One is tempted to think that Republicans, being evil, don't just keel over, and they don't die young. Apparently, there is something of a fountain of youth effect about being purely, unutterably evil. It kept Rehnquist on the court, even though he was a junkie. And it has kept Scalia on the court, and he's in his 70s. Thomas is no spring chicken. Kennedy's not exactly a kid. But they seem to just toddle right along, writing hateful opinions and joining in hateful majorities and screwing people who will not be born for 50 years. Dig that! Your vote counts. This is not the time to start the discussion about the electronic voting machines. I'm talking philosophically. I'm talking big picture, broad brush strokes here. It's time to try to pull it together, and I'm going to try to be a part of that. Am I going to sit here and tell you that any presidential candidate is the neatest thing since sliced bread? No. There's not that much of my idealism left. I've got a little bit of idealism left, and I sort of guard it closely. I keep it locked away in a little corner of my soul, and I take it out and look at it once in a while, and it's all pristine and clean and shiny and pretty. And then I lock it safely, tightly away again before it can get filthied up by the world we live in now. So we'll take a little break, listen to a little tune. I'll catch my breath. We'll see who's on the phone, and we'll come back. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn, and I'm Bob Kincaid.
to rhyme, and I used to hate the fool in me, but only in the morning now I tolerate him all day long.
Your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
All righty then. Let's see if we can do another hour of conversation radio. We'll go to the phones in a second. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. If you've got your very own little unlimited long-distance dialing plan, you can save us a nickel or a buck, as our good friend Peter Godbold says, by dialing 304-658-5453. Look forward to hearing from you. Quick email rolls in before we go to the phone. Our pal Cindy writes, I just tuned in to hear the walking, talking preacher man comment re Obama. I went to Ted Kennedy's PAC site, Committee for a Democratic Majority, and let them have it about Hillary and Obama being corporate-sponsored candidates who would never, ever give us nationalized medicine because they're both beholden to the insurance companies. I told them how I pay over $1,200 a month on medical insurance and asked them how much they think that kind of loose change would stimulate the economy. I said I think Senator Kennedy supported Obama to make John Kerry happy because he's mad at Edwards. Then I said the people are mad at Kerry for quitting on us after we fielded and funded 50 law offices across the nation to stand by and take on lawsuits at polling places across the states if they refused recounts. Kerry quit so fast we couldn't even make the call. So I asked them what was more important to them, the people or Kerry's feelings. I then told them that I do not work for John Edwards, but I want him in office because he's the only man who is not beholden to the corporations. He's his own man and a man of the people. Not Obama. He's a man for the corporations. It's my take. Thanks, Cindy. And I share a lot of that. But again, let me reiterate. Come November, I will vote for the Democratic nominee, period, because my great-grandchildren mean too much to me, unborn and undreamt of, to let a McCain or a Romney or a Giuliani or a Huckabee screw it up with Supreme Court nominations. But that's just me. And to the phones, we have Gary calling from Maryland. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Bob?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
Okay, doing good. Can you hear me?
I got you just fine.
Okay, great. Actually, after the South Carolina thing, I think it turned pretty clear to me that I don't think Edwards is gonna. I don't think he's gonna make it this time. So I decided I went over to the rally actually today because you know I live in Maryland, so I actually went over to American University to see Ted Kennedy endorse Obama.
Okay.
And I was online for a while, you know, I got the, you know, people were there, like, they got there at like 7 o'clock in the morning for like a 12 o'clock speech. And like the line was just, it was just ridiculous. There was just so many people there. But the one good thing about it while I was standing online, you know, for that long time, I got a chance to sit really were kind of linking the Clintons and the Bushes in some abstract way together.
I don't necessarily. I understand the Bush Clinton Bush Clinton thing, but I don't think there's an actual intellectual or spiritual or moral or physical nexus between them.
Yeah, see, and I'm kind of the same way. I mean, even though I do have, you know, this whole thing with NAFTA. I mean, Bill Clinton did cave on that, and it's kind of, you know, it's obviously been a terrible situation for the, you know, for America.
Well, to be fair, I don't think he caved. He's an active proponent of globalism and free trade agreements.
Yeah, but let me ask you a question. If you're an active proponent of it, then why don't you be also active about when you hear about these things about child labor, you know, and all these other countries where you have NAFTA, and you're not going to these other countries and saying, hey, impose these standards, because in its purest sense, NAFTA seems to just be a way for American corporations to go into other countries, relax the rules so that they can make as much profit as possible, sell the stuff back here to us, and in most cases now they're actually taking their situations overseas and they're just setting up shop at the expense of the taxpayers, and they're not really planning to coming back. They're planning staying over there because those markets are emerging. So they're basically taking their own business models over there. And I think to some degree, I do think Clinton gets too much of a pass on that. I mean, I'm just sorry. I mean, you look at what, it's like Reagan started the union busting, which bust down the union. And then Clinton just came in and pretty much wrote a check for them to go over there. Now I know that there was a Republican Congress at the time, and you know, he was kind of handicapped in that sense, and I also know that he did want to put regulations, but the fact of the matter is, and we all know this, that he's always been somewhat of a centrist. I mean, that's what they ran on. That's how, you know, that's really their power base, and they gave some concessions that I think that has to call into question if Hillary was to get back into office. Are they going to go down that same track, or are they going to revert back to the America that we once knew, where, you know, we had more protections here from something like a free trade agreement that's not as fair? I mean, that
if I'm not mistaken, Gary, both Hillary and Obama voted in favor of the latest round of free trade agreements, being the Peru.
Yeah.
Free trade agreement.
Correct.
Am I wrong on that?
You're correct.
And an excuse was put forward saying, well, you know, there are labor protections in place. No, there weren't. If, for instance, you read David Sirota's coverage of it, he was spot on about it. And you're exactly right in your description of these free trade agreements, Gary, because in order for the free trade agreement to be, for a free trade agreement to be what people have described it and wanted it to be, it has to move any individual country involved in one toward a level playing field. And we are the level playing field being moved toward, because the high-wage jobs are always at risk from the low-wage jobs. And anytime there's a risk of child labor, forced labor, any of those things that we say we deplore, if there's an opportunity to use it in a free trade agreement country that we can't do here, we're at a disadvantage. And you don't remedy the disadvantage by reinstating child labor and forced labor in this country. The purpose is to raise them up, not to drag us down, and that's what's happening. We're getting dragged down.
But see, here's the thing, the difference is Mr. Clinton was the president. He had the veto power. It's not like Mrs. Clinton, who signed, you know, who went with the Peru deal, or Obama, who went to the Peru deal. We know there's a senator's bill, and you have a lot of finagling over it. It wasn't like they actually had to sponsor it.
Well, yeah, exactly, Gary. Consider that one of the few jobs that is given to the president under Article 2 of the Constitution is that he is the sole negotiator of treaties with other nations.
That's right.
So NAFTA, before Congress could ever do anything with it, NAFTA had to be negotiated by the White House. So, you really can't say, well, you know, Bill Clinton had NAFTA forced on him. No, Bill Clinton wanted NAFTA. Bill Clinton ached for NAFTA. Bill Clinton also granted permanent, mind you, it used to be that the Congress would consider most favored nation status with regard to other nations on a periodic basis. It was during the Clinton administration that permanent most favored nation status was granted to China. And that was granted by the White House. It wasn't rammed down his throat by a Republican Congress.
The thing, I think there was an article about 8 more years by Ralph Nader that he just wrote recently, and he goes really go through the whole process of Clinton and NAFTA, and he just really breaks it down about how, you know, Clinton has always been in bed with the corporations. And I guess my thing is this, and I look at it from this point of view, and I told you I look at this from this point of view. I already know what Clinton's going to do with the corporations. I'd rather have somebody like Obama or Edwards in there who I feel can be turned or twisted, who can listen to the people this time, and because see, Clinton didn't have the benefit of seeing obviously what was going to happen with what he's done. Obama and Edwards now see how it's tearing up, so I'm assuming that they're going to do the right thing, because it's the same thing with the bankruptcy bill. I mean, that's the only thing I had a problem with Edwards. I'm like, why would you sign on this bankruptcy bill when you're championing, you know, all of this stuff, and then you give the credit card company this great way to punish so many people? So then you got to wonder about that. But we have to kind of look at the situation and say, look, the situation is so grave now. Hopefully, even if Mr. Clinton gets in there, that they're going to change. My only problem with the Clintons is I know that they have these old relationships. They have lobbyists in their pockets, probably even Obama too, that who are going to be still putting pressure on them to do things the same old way to finally push through this agenda they have. And that is where I kind of say, at the Hillary Clintons, I cut them off right there, because I'm pretty much sure, I'm pretty much convinced they're going to continue to give the corporations a break. They'll give us some little petty, you know, little things that keep us quiet, but ultimately I feel like they're going to just finish the deal what they already pushed through. I mean, it's just the classic kind of like the world has changed, and George Bush brings in Cheney and Rumsfeld from the 80s with these same plans that don't work in his future. And now I feel like Bill and Hillary are going to come with these same plans they've had. They said, oh, they didn't work this time, but let's try them again. I think we need a little new leadership, and that's what everybody who I talked to online really was saying. They're saying it's time for change in Washington.
Do you sense that there's a carryover factor from South Carolina into Super Tuesday, Gary?
I'm a cynical person by nature. I'm gonna tell you that right now. I'm just cynical, but I don't feel like Obama's gonna win, because I think there is a machine in place. Personally, I mean, I don't want to go conspiracy theory, but I think there's a machine in place. I think there. I mean, we don't have to even go to JFK. We can go back through MLK. We can go back through all these things. We are seeing the same kind of stuff. Whenever the movement is right, whenever somebody comes along, everybody starts to have doubt, and everybody has something is changing. You see it. That is what this is about. You're talking about South Carolina. You could see it. I mean, we could sit here and like try to debate and try to say, oh, he didn't say this, he didn't say that. But it's not him talking, Bob. It's the people are talking. When I sat there today and I was looking at the crowd, it was all diverse people. I mean, it was diverse, and they were excited. I mean, I was talking to this little girl. She was like in front of me with her father. She was like 13 years old. She was just going on and on and on. I mean, these people are excited. And I think we may be missing the chance where we're getting kind of caught up and scared about this and that we don't realize that this is not about race only. This is about generation. This is about the future of these kids getting involved. And they're getting involved. And they're going to make the decisions. They're going to be just, trust me, if Obama or Edward gets in the White House, do you think that they're just going to have total carte blanche to do whatever they want, whatever their agenda is? I guarantee you, no, that's not going to happen. And I think this whole thing with the Kennedys is to let you know that we're going to move this thing back to the left wing. See, my whole thing with the DLC, and, you know, I don't want to go into the Clintons, but I'm going to just say this plain and simple. The Clintons and the DLC leadership, as I told you, I used to work in there, they have decided to become Republicans. That is why what you see going on, everybody's like all of a Paul, because, Bob, they're Republicans. They basically are running, they're trying to run the country, because they looked at the Republicans and say, wow, they put together this 30-year machine, and they think that's the only model that works.
Oh, man. We could do an hour on that one, Gary. I'm so glad you brought that up.
No, I'm serious, because I was in the DLC. I'm not talking to sound like, I don't want to even sound like, because I told you before, I used to love Hillary Clinton.
No. I'm not disagreeing with you. The idea of the right wing building a machine And the left wing looking at it, left wing, you know, I don't believe there's a left wing, no, at least not much of one. But the idea, that, and you can apply it in so many different areas, the idea that, the left, having taken a couple of whippings, that we took a look at the way the right wing was doing it and assumed that that was the only way to do it, whether it is courting Wall Street bankers or insurance companies or big pharma or the hospital healthcare industry, you know, and trying to get the money that the right wing had, or whether it's the model of how radio works. If you assume that you have to adopt the other side's model in order to succeed, instead of doing the hard skull sweat of figuring out how you motivate your people, I think you're bound to fail.
Yeah, you're bound to fail. And the thing is, Bill and Hillary had so much capital coming into this. They had so much capital. And see, this is where I was getting back. You know, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago. I hope you are, guys, because pretty much talked about this. It's just like Bush. Think about it. I'm going to draw a great analogy here, Bob, and I hope everybody hears this. Bush came in with a lot of capital. When 2001 and everything hit, when that you know, the World Trade Center and everything, everybody knows he had the world in his hand. Everybody was behind America. What did he do? Listen to everybody who's listened to this radio show. He divided the country. Now, here comes Hillary. Democratic Party is strong and everything, yada, yada, yada. What did they do? What did they do? They divide the party. If we don't realize that that is a signal from whatever being or spiritual thing you believe in or whatever, or if you don't believe in that, it's showing you right up front, they are not the right people to lead us where we need to go. Anything that divides is not right to me, you know. And we can sit here and talk about Obama or anything. My thing is this. With Obama, same thing like you were saying, how he voted on this energy thing that's not good for, you know, coal mining, you know, expansions and things that, you know, out there in West Virginia where the mountains are getting blown up. But here's the thing. You have a lot of people not motivated. You should be able to have people who now can go and say, hey, this is an issue. We're all going to come together to deal with this issue. That is what I'm thinking in the abstract, where I'm hoping that's thinking, that he's basically saying, let's find the best ideas to all our solutions by everybody coming together as one voice and talk in that. Because, like, Martin Luther King was not necessarily interested in doing a lot of civil rights stuff. He had to be pushed to doing that. The same thing with Obama. Personally, the reason why I wasn't necessarily initially attracted to him, because from what I knew, he was kind of conservative-leaning. But I kind of think now, and I think the Ted Kennedy thing makes me realize, they're pulling him over, and they're saying, hey, this guy's an asset. We can use him to set our agenda, and he has a lot of capital coming in because the youth people are motivating people. And I think he's not saying to him, to say, we got to stop thinking like our president. It's like a king. He works for us. We're supposed to go there and say, hey, look, these are our petitions. Make it happen. I mean, this whole thing with Bush being a king and, like, he's setting agenda, I think is, like, backwards. And we got to stop thinking like that. We got to think like Kennedy did say, that, you know, ask what we can do for our country. And I think that's where we have to kind of, you know, I think that's where we got to go at this point. And that's kind of like, that's where I'm at right now. I'm very scared with Clinton. I'm just, that's just me.
It sounds a lot like where I am. I want, like I said, I keep my idealism hidden away and I don't take it out and let it see the light of day very often because I trust or I cherish what little bit of it I have. But I want...
Here's somebody possibly who can bring that up, the idealism back.
I think it is far more likely to happen with Obama than it is with Senator Clinton.
And to some fairness to Hillary, I think that... I guess there's another side to this, that I know that the right wing is cranking up hardcore against her. They're going to do the same thing with Obama, whoever it is.
Yeah.
But I kind of like at this point, if they got dirt, I want to hear some new dirt. I don't want to hear the same old dirt crap that I heard for 400 years about Bill and Hillary. I got this strange feeling that if we can get some of those, and I'm kind of a little different on you in this, because the whole thing I think what Obama was saying about that Reagan thing, I think what he was trying to say in the abstract sense was, let's get some of those Republicans to realize what we're doing is actually good for them. Because Reagan was able to convince some Democrats what he was doing to them you know, it's actually bad for them, but he actually convinced them to come over. I think that's kind of like what Obama is saying. I think if we could get some more of those Republicans, as bad as some of them are, but I think if we can get some of them to come over to the party and say, you know what, I'm over here now, that will, like, knock the Hannitys and it will marginalize them because they don't have that majority anymore. You know, and I think that's what the Democrats are like, we're in the need of right now. And I would just say, you know, let's try to just step out on some faith on this one. Now, I know he doesn't have a lot of experience. You know, we always have a concern. But I would take...
Did you see...
I would take a little bit... I mean, well, look, he can't be worse than Bush. and I think he's...
There's that for starters. there's absolutely...
Somebody, yeah. He could have just came over to campus and said, I'm better than Bush. But I did notice something that somebody mentioned today on the thing. When you look at all the other candidates, it was even Hillary. You notice that all signs have a name on it?
Yeah.
Obama's signs always says change. It's not his name on it. His name is always down small. He's speaking directly to us. That's what he's doing. He's telling us to change. You know, let's stop thinking negative about, you know, whatever, and let's believe again that we can get things done. What Bush has showed us, don't believe in government. Don't believe they can do anything. See, look at FEMA. We'll screw it up for you just to prove it. And Obama's saying the opposite. And that's when I was sitting there talking to a lot of people on there. That's kind of what I came to this enlightenment, is that that's what this whole thing is about. I didn't even notice the change. I was just looking at it like, you know, he don't even have his name on his sign. You know? He's talking to us. This is for us to do something. You know, this is a movement. And he may not win, but I'm 100% sure after being there today, he's going to be president one day.
Gary, let me share something with you real quick, because you might find this quite interesting if you haven't seen it already. It was Toni Morrison who declared that Bill Clinton was our first black president, if you recall. And she did it because he was the son of a single mother. He grew up poor in a rural, backward southern state. And so that, you know, it even showed up in a debate not too long back.
Yeah.
Well, she came out, and she has endorsed who? Barack Obama. She wrote...
Say what?
She endorsed Barack Obama now. And what she said is... I'm sorry?
Oh, okay. I was just asking, did she say why she did it?
Well, this is the quote. In addition to keen intelligence, integrity, and a rare authenticity, you exhibit something that has nothing to do with age, experience, race, or gender, and something I don't see in other candidates. That something is a creative imagination which, coupled with brilliance, equals wisdom. It is too bad if we associate it only with gray hair and old age, or if we call searing vision naivete, or if we believe cunning is insight, or if we settle for finessing cures tailored for each ravaged tree in the forest while ignoring the poisonous landscape that feeds and surrounds it. Wisdom is a gift. You can't train for it, inherit it, learn it in a class, or earn it in the workplace. That access can foster the acquisition of knowledge, but not wisdom. That's pretty profound, isn't it?
Thing with Clinton, though, speaking of Bill Clinton in that context, and she named him the first black president, thing is with Clinton is, and I don't say that, I don't make this charge against people, but the true class of racism is whenever a person uses his race to hold down another race. And one thing's clear for me, and you know, I'll say it's pretty much plain, as African American. Bill Clinton is a racist. Now, he didn't become a racist over the course of his life. He's done a lot of things in the course of his life with black people. Like I said before, I had a strong affinity for him, too. That I even, when people said he's a black president, a black person, we all would laugh and smile. I talked about people when I was in the barbershop last week, we were just talking, and they brought up Bill Clinton's name. they were using the F word and everything else. No, I'm serious. And they are, they're to the point now that a lot of them said they're not even going to come out and vote if Hillary's on the ticket. I mean, that's where the point is. And the thing was, when he came out yesterday, and I don't know if he says taken out of context, but when he said that Jesse Jackson won in 1980, in 88, I'm thinking to myself, why don't you just say John Edwards won South Carolina in 2004 and lost? Why would you go back to Jesse Jackson? You know? It's like, how long are you going to play this race card? It's like, you think we're stupid as African-Americans? See, I knew when she said that whole thing about MLK, I know they were talking in code. I know what code is. You know what code is.
Mm-hmm.
Say something that sounds like something else, that nobody can refute what you said is true, but it's speaking. So I know what she was saying. She was saying that an African male like Obama, because, you know, people make that reference to him, cannot run like a white person. In its most abstract form, if you talk to a black person, that's what she was saying. We know the code. We've heard it before. I gave her a pass on that. But when I knew she was playing the race card, it's when she sent her house Negro, Bob Johnson, on that Sunday morning while she was sitting right next to him, to go and start trashing Barack Obama. That's when I said they're playing the card. Because that's how you play. You always go find an African-American who, as Bob Johnson is, has demonized more black people than Clarence Thomas or any Supreme Court justice could ever do. With that disgusting BET channel that, you know, put out all those, you know, terrible images of black women and black people and black men as pimps and thugs. I mean, that's how he made $1 billion off that crap. So for Hillary to sit there next to a person like that, I mean, I've really lost respect for them. And we really have to kind of look at this and say it ourselves.
I find the Jesse Jackson comment offensive in the extreme, Gary.
But why didn't he just, for Bob, they told him, he knew he was playing the race car early on. Why would he keep going with it? You're a white male. Why would he keep going with that?
I think it's not so much white male, but white male ex-president.
Okay.
Because... Bill Clinton does not like losing anything, and he is highly invested from an emotional stand and spiritual standpoint in his wife's candidacy. As such, if you've seen the video confrontations with reporters or with people who ask him questions that he doesn't like, he becomes immediately very, very confrontational. And when he and he does that because as president, and I think we noted it, maybe it was you, there was always somebody else who did the dirty work for him when he was campaigning for president. There was always a Begala or a Carville or a Sid Blumenthal or, you know, one of those folks out there who would handle the nastiness. And he wants to get down and do some hardcore fighting. I really sense that, because he does have that Southerner's sense of insult to integrity where his wife is concerned. I referenced it the other night. And the reason he does that is that for all the political acumen that he has, that stuff outweighs what's going on in his... Let's put it this way. The politics happens in his lizard brain. The stuff that is regarding his wife, and I will assume, because I have no reason not to, that a relationship that has lasted that long and with that kind of commitment has a significant element of love and mutual love and respect in it, that takes place in a different part of his spirit. And so it's the urge to whomp somebody in the face with a white glove and meet him on the plains of Weehawken in the morning, if you know what I mean. But the Jesse Jackson comment was nothing if not an attempt to marginalize the victory in South Carolina, because the demographics were so stunning and so damning that they had to find some way of trying to make sense of it and to say, well, you know, Jesse Jackson won South Carolina, so what?
But did you see, you saw Ted's speech today. I mean, that speech by Senator Kennedy, I mean, that was a loaded speech. I mean, he's always have a sharp tongue anyway. But that speech, when you went through it, I mean, he really was, and afterwards was blasting Bill Clinton. You know, with just some of the stuff he said. I mean, you know, it was just very sharp about the divisive politics. I mean, he talked about that. And it's really to see, with me as an African American, like I said before, once you play the race card and you keep playing it over and over, I eventually have to just walk away from it. I'm a forgiving person, just like a lot of people are. But there's a point where, you know, I can't turn a cheek anymore. And with the Clintons, if this is how they want to win the White House, by taking the pain of slavery and race and lynching and all this other stuff that they claim to fight civil rights for, I say to myself now, you know what? You were just using us as a political football. Because you're telling me now that you're willing to sacrifice just to get to White House, you know, the struggles of African-American people and race to get to the White House. And everything that you've done before, to me, says you really was just doing it because it benefited you. You understand what I'm saying, Paul?
I do understand it. I hate to say it, but did you see the video of him on MLK Day in the church?
Yes, sir.
Where he falls asleep?
Yeah, looking at his watch.
Yeah.
You would think he would be sitting there, like, motivated, like, wow, you know. Maybe the sermon was bad. Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, I heard the preacher, man, and I mean, it wasn't exactly dull. And God knows, at least through my speakers, it wasn't soft and melodious either. I think, to be fair, I think that was a function of looking at a guy who's been on the campaign trail and is just flat exhausted.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I thought. But like I said before, it's clear to me now he's been using African, this whole thing about civil rights, as, you know, political football. Even thing with, like I said last time, with the African, with the AIDS initiative. Look, a lot of Africans died on his watch. Rwanda, he totally just really, you know, the British government and especially the American government, they knew about that stuff, but they didn't act. And he even now goes and interviews how he feels regret for that. So it starts to make me wonder, did he actually have these concerns about people of color as well, which he claims so much to have? I just think really now it's coming to find out what the Clintons really were just ambushed, ambitious, street-fighting thug politicians who pretty much would do whatever they had to do to win and were very good at it. And they just happened to come into our party. And since our party had some good ideals, they looked good. But it didn't mean they were good. It didn't mean that they actually deserved to hold the mantle or the torch for what we stand for. And to me, the torch for the Clintons is burned out. And as far as I'm concerned, I think Teddy Kennedy, what he said is right. We've got to give somebody else at this point. Let somebody else light it. Let somebody else carry it. And I say the best ticket we got going right now is Obama Edwards. And I'm going to stick to that. I hear you with the whole thing about the Supreme Court. But I can guarantee you this. I strongly feel that if Hillary becomes president, this country is going to go even further into the abyss. I think they actually,
okay, let's qualify that for just a quick second there, Gary. Further into the abyss, okay. Further into the abyss than it would with John McCain? Further than with Romney? Huckabee? Giuliani?
I told you I had a cutoff with Huckabee and Giuliani. I said if Giuliani and Huckabee was there, I would vote for Hillary because I think that's far. The whole thing with the McCain and Hillary, I'm kind of like in a toss-up. And I talked to a lot of people because a lot of people there online were independent, mainly independent white voters. You know, I mean, not a lot of people. I'm just saying there were many there. And I talked to them. And some of them were kind of saying, you know, well, we were kind of in the McCain camp. That's where they were coming from. But they were like, well, you know, they were totally against the war, so that's why they were coming over. So she has a little bit of a problem with McCain. I see that. I saw that when I was there today. I'm not really ready to say I would vote for her if McCain was there. I'm not there yet. I mean, I just can't. You know, African-American, maybe I'm just a little too emotional about it with the whole race card thing.
How about if it's McCain-Lieberman?
Lieberman on any ticket. now changes everything.
Yeah, that
say Lieberman, that changes anything. I'm sorry, putting Giuliani on the ticket. I mean Giuliani, Lieberman, I am out hugging Bill. Tell him to come over for dinner, eat some fried chicken with me, man.
Stumping for Hillary.
I'm stumping for Hillary, Dow. I mean, I like you or whatever. You know, you can even use the N-word, whatever. Just kidding.
Yeah, no Lieberman. No Joe Mendham.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You think it's going to be a Lieberman McCain ticket?
I don't know, Gary, but I saw the other day where he made him his official, you know, gave him the secret decoder ring and the certificate suitable for framing and made him his Connecticut campaign chair. And something inside me said, Joe is drumming his fingers and wanting his name on another bumper sticker.
Well, he was in Florida yesterday. I saw something. He was in Sarasota campaigning with him. And then he was talking about people get ready because there's going to be more wars and more wars. I'm thinking, McCain has lost his mind. The guy really has gone.
Yeah, but you gotta dig the fact that the conventional wisdom among the so-called centrists and moderates, be they Democrats or Republicans, says that Lieberman can sure bring in the Florida Jewish vote. And if you think that's not why he's on board, if you think that's not why he was named last week to be the Connecticut chair of the McCain campaign, last week, so that he could be in Florida campaigning in the last few days before this hotly contested Republican primary, that's exactly why.
Yeah, and of course, and then Hillary Strong in the New Jersey tri-state area, which there's a large Jewish population. Of course, that you thinking probably that way to bring him on, you know.
Unless it's the, I don't know. Maybe Mark Levine could straighten me up on this or something. But I don't get where the American Jewish community is all in love with Joe Lieberman anymore.
Well, I can't say that. The only thing I would say this is in regards to Hillary Clinton. You don't think that if she got into office and that, just like George Bush, if she got into a situation that she too would not become a warmonger just to keep the heat off her from the Republicans and help just feed their little machine, give them some bones, say, okay, we're going to just continue to do
that? That's the problem with the whole Iraqcupation, Gary, and the question that I've been asking for a couple of years now is when the Democrats are going to figure out that George Bush is going to leave Iraq in place, barring them forcing him to end it. He's going to leave it in place so the cleanup and the mess and the blank, you know, fill in the blank, lost the Iraq war, does not get George Bush put there. This is an end game, and I don't think anybody in the Democratic Party's been playing it.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing. That was actually the first thing when I started to move away from Hillary. When I actually first started getting pissed with her, it was about this whole war thing and like how she was waffling on. And then she was like, it almost to the point where it was almost like she was supporting it. It's like, oh no, we got. And then I was just like, I couldn't take it. I just couldn't take it because the war has been the biggest issue for me. I've been to the rallies here in D.C., done other stuff. That's been the biggest issue to me. I mean, when that night, I don't know about how it happened with you, but I'm pretty sure you're the same. The night that war started, I couldn't sleep because I knew that was it May 2000, whatever, 2003, that people were dying.
I was physically ill, Gary, and I wept. And yeah, I didn't sleep well.
I didn't sleep. I went on. I turned on the TV. I just sat there in front of the TV, and I was watching Fox. And the people on Fox, Bob, were sitting there like talking about this whole shock and awe. And they're like, "Well, when are we going to see the explosion? I mean, you've seen it. It looks like." Craziest thing. I said, what am I watching? This is not a video game. People are going to die. And all these Republicans running around here with their freaking flag. Like, do you understand? People are going to die. To remove.
It was shortly after we started that, and we, you know, that's the war we started. It was shortly after that, Gary, that I read Mark Twain's The War Prayer on air the first time. And I don't know, but what I should have been reading it once a week ever since. Because it was just—it's just such a perfect manifestation, and the thing's 100 years old now. but it was the same the day it was written as it was 100 years later, the way that the American people tend to respond to war. I mentioned the Ken Burns Civil War documentary. Go back and watch that and watch how they marched in the streets in Massachusetts and New York and Minnesota and Iowa and Chicago and all over the country, you know, just and the South. Everybody, woo-wee, going to have a war. Boy, this is going to be fun. It ain't fun, and it's not nice, and it's nothing to cheer about. The way the United States is set up, Gary, the only time we should ever go to war is when war is made on us.
Yeah, we don't need to go to war. We don't, you know, we know. Look, we know all of why we got all these bases around the world. So they can expand the corporations all around the world, so they can tell the population, "Hey, don't act up while we're setting up shop here." And then once we get everything all copacetic, then we'll just, you know, then we'll start pulling people out. I mean, that's what this is all about. Why are we everywhere? What is it, like 750?
900 and some, I thought.
Yeah, like army base. We're not even talking about small embassies and all this other kind of stuff. So I guess, why do we have to be in every place on the earth?
Because we're the new Rome, man.
Exactly.
We are. Gary, I love these conversations.
All right, man. Well, I'm going to let you go. But
chime in anytime, my friend.
All right. We'll talk.
Take care. Bye now. And we'll move on now. Hi, who have I got?
This is Chris.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Hey, did you know that there is a certain part of Virginia that is so conservative that they won't let Tom Clancy turn off his car and park? There is a think tank there that is more thinker and tanker than Henry Kissinger has cloven hooves. And in that thinker and tanker and cloven hoof in place, there are some of Henry Kissinger's illegitimate children. There's four of them.
Okay.
And the one that was actually born with a scalp is sitting there. And he's saying, we can't let Mitt Romney in there. He's the one that ruined that really good man that lived in a little room by himself in Vegas. The Mormons. They'll did it to him. They'll do it to the... Like, we can't do it. Anyway. Okay.
You're just bad.
Bad, bad, bad. Did you know that in New Hampshire, there for a while, if you closed your door on a McCain person that knocked on your door at 4 a.m., McCain himself would be peeking a little peephole of your door and kicking the door and screaming and cussing? That's why he did so good. What I heard.
What are we going to do with you?
That's what I heard.
Just saying.
How long ago was it that I said on this very show, this incredible, wonderful show, that Hillary had gone so far, that little line that goes down the middle of the road and you get on it and it hums, that I didn't hear it anymore from her?
Yeah.
Well, that broad has just...
Broad?
Okay, she's lost some weight. What do you want?
Woo! You're gonna get me in trouble yet.
Well, hey.
The distinguished junior senator from New York has...
Oh, okay. All righty. Has left whatever she intended to do. And has defied whatever she hoped to do and is now and forever will be in the pocket of whatever could have been.
Yeah. I don't want to turn this into an anti-Hillary thing because I may wind up having to vote for her.
I'm not.
Chris, what, McCain? Romney? Yeah, because I can see Chris going into a voting booth in northwest Alabama and going, I'm a Romney man!
Now, how can Romney win when you know it's practically impossible for him to find a VP in a glove? Come on. It's impossible. You can't do it. A social conservative named Glove running with Mitt. It's just, no.
I know. But seriously,
I'll, if it comes down to that, I will more than likely abstain. I will more than likely abstain.
Now, you've got
to... I don't really see a difference between the two.
Chris, the difference lies in the Supreme Court, brother.
Well...
I mean, I know you've got a young'un, just like I got young'uns, and there might be little Mansells out there, yet unborn and undreamt of, 2-3 generations down the road, that one more right-wing Supreme Court justice will screw forever, and they don't even know they've been screwed.
Well, stuff gets screwed all the time in this country, and it's allowed to happen. The Supreme Court has nothing to do with it. The laws of this country have nothing to do with it. So it's not all about the law.
No, but if you go back and you look at something like the Dred Scott decision, I mentioned Dred Scott because, you know, in fact, he did work in Florence.
Well,
before he went to Missouri and tried to get free, and Roger Taney issued that decision that said, Dred Scott is still screwing America.
Well,
the Dred Scott decision, that is. Plessy versus Ferguson is still screwing America. So, you know, I just keep coming back to this thesis, Chris, that while a president can only screw up America for no more than 8 years, his Supreme or her Supreme Court appointments can screw up America for hundreds of years.
Well, how about a democracy based on the idea of 55 white guys holding the truth self-evident to a bunch of 55 rich, landowning, for the most part, slave-owning white guys, holding the truth self-evident, that had no slaves, no Indians, and no women.
Oh, I know. This is not the part of the program where I say that the United States was born of nobility.
Yeah.
I remember Thomas Jefferson, with regard to slavery, saying, it's like having hold of a wolf by the ears, talking about slavery. It's like having a hold of a wolf by the ears. You don't want to hang on, but you don't dare let go.
Yeah, that's like you were talking about the laws, the Supreme Court. I've become so disillusioned. I mean, until the laws does something about so many different things. Oh, man.
You're pointing up something, Chris, and that is the absolute necessity, not just for change in the White House, but for change in the Congress. For my money, I'd like to see the House of Representatives get a bigger Democratic majority, and I'd like to see the Senate get a filibuster-proof Democratic majority. Then we can start getting things that we want, like the Employee Free Choice Act. And maybe, I don't know, even a little bit of a palace coup in the House of Representatives and get a real speaker instead of Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer.
I want mandatory. I want when a Catholic priest molests a child, I don't want them to be able to be flown out of the country or moved to another church. I want them to serve the sentence that requires the act, and I don't want them to be able to be paid off. The family, the Vatican will be able to pay them off. I want them to be tested. And if their test is positive, I want the court to go from there.
I understand that. And I'm getting told in the chat room, but we need to run all the Blue Dog Dems and Dinos out too. I understand that.
There's tons of stuff like that that's not going to get changed, no matter who's in there. And that stuff that's why I haven't called in a long time, because I get my blood boiling about this, and there's...
You want to chuck it all and start over again.
You better believe it. You better believe it.
I want an eight bedroom house sitting on 500 acres.
I don't.
And a car that runs on sunshine. Now, I'm not making fun of you.
No, you're smarter than that.
There are things that are accomplishable in the short term, and there are things that are accomplishable in the long term.
My vote for two people like that.
Just
if it's between McCain or Hillary, I'm standing in the middle of the tunnel, and they're both coming the same way, and I can't make myself invisible.
That's precisely my point. Even in that instance, an abstention is a vote in its own right.
I understand that, and I can live with that. And I understand, you understand, just like the great line of Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, I can understand the point of view of the fox and the hound. I can understand your point, and I can understand my point, but I can't live with myself voting for either one of them, because I just can't.
But what happens then if, let's say for a moment that you get, let's say for a moment that we get McCain, all right? And he goes absolutely Manchurian candidate, bug spray crazy. Yeah, good point. Yeah, and you're the one making it, you know. And you didn't get out and try to stop him. How do you get through the night?
Well, how do we know? She wasn't going to get us back. I had a thing I wrote here recently where the White House, but the press corps on the campaign trail was calling him Rectal Randy. You know, who knows if they weren't. He scares me, and I had a friend of mine who is out there liberal doesn't even begin to describe this guy. And he said, and he's been wanting Bush out even more than me, and boy, that is really, you read my writing, that is really out there. And he said, can you even begin to imagine the corruption that will be in her administration?
Yeah, I don't necessarily buy into that, Chris, because is that an extrapolation from the Clinton administration? Because if it is, only one Clinton administration official ever got criminally charged.
No. That's not based on the Clinton administration. I only have a few things wrong with the Clinton administration, and one of them caused the death of probably only about 500,000 people by the time they could have really done something.
The Saddam sanctions? Or the Rwanda thing?
Rwanda.
Okay, see, between the Iraq sanctions under the Clinton administration killed between 500,000 and 1 million children.
Mm-hmm.
The matter of just...
Rwanda really could
sitting
have been very easily.
And then sitting and blithely ignoring Rwanda, that was another 500,000 to 1 million.
Yeah, that was 800,000.
So, you know, nobody gets a pass on that. NAFTA, I got a big problem with NAFTA. But again, I don't see corruption under Hillary Clinton being a problem. My God, we're going to be coming out of the Bush administration. They will have written the book on corruption by then.
Somewhere in some dark chamber, I can imagine Bush thinking, boy, I'm going to get the broker to pay still. Somewhere in that sick, twisted mind.
Well, let's wait for tonight and his speechifying and see what comes out in the way of legacy material. That's something to keep an eye out for if I can stay sober long enough. Because he really does drive me to drink. I'm sorry.
I don't have television or the internet, so I'm sure I'll find out eventually.
You got a radio?
Yeah, but I don't know.
I'm sure they'll bust in on National Public Radio to run it. I know I am, but you know what? It's worth doing, because we've got to remind ourselves where we are before we can talk about where we want to be.
I understand that, but...
See, I fall asleep at night, and I have McCain, Romney, Giuliani, Huckabee nightmares. Because I know that given the damage that's been done to this country, we can't take another 4 years. We're not going to get anything in the way of even a discussion about every American being able to go to the doctor when they're sick under a McCain, a Romney, a Giuliani, or a Huckabee. Fortunately, on our side, among the Democrats, we've already started that discussion. And Senator Clinton's a part of the discussion. Senator Obama's part of the discussion. Senator Edwards is, and unfortunately that he's out now, the best part of the discussion was being had by Dennis Kucinich. And God bless him, he dragged the other so-called mainstream candidates into an understanding of what has to happen for health care in this country.
You better believe it. I just love Kucinich to death.
So the point, Chris...
I have no problem with Kucinich, you know that. And I have no problem with Obama, but... Hillary just worries the living crap out of me. I'm sorry, that's my opinion, and everybody's got one.
Well, you're you are welcome to it.
Yeah.
However, I must urge you to think long and hard on this. However, Chris, because no matter what misgiving you may have, pick an issue. The war in Iraq, she's talking credibly about getting out of it. John McCain isn't. Romney isn't. Huckabee isn't. Giuliani isn't.
I wouldn't vote for a Republican to save Waterloo. Now, you know what I'm talking about. Nobody else does.
I do understand.
You know how much that means to me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it.
So,
but look at it this way: history is a fickle thing. It wasn't until the 1970s that John Brown was considered in our textbooks as a saint.
I know.
How the textbooks gonna treat the Bush administration? John Brown wasn't considered a sane person. He was always considered insane and crazy for being what he did in what is now West Virginia.
I know. And yeah, I had the textbooks that called it the War of Northern Aggression too.
Yeah. But Bob, the best thing about all this discussion and everything is the fantastic, wonderful, superb job you were doing in your show.
Well, thank you, Chris. I do appreciate it.
If you can't play in this country, call up and say what we will.
I hope folks will continue to do so.
Well, I don't see why they wouldn't.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very kindly. My best to your family.
And mine to yours.
All right.
Bye.
Bye now. Our good friend Chris Mansell calling from the old home stomping grounds of Northwest Alabama. And onward. Hi, who have I got?
Bob?
Yes.
That's Pat.
Hey, Pat, how are you?
Good. I haven't been listening. I just, since I've been on hold is what I've heard tonight, so I don't know what you've been talking about. But I am, as you know and people in the chat know, I just got a new job. I'm a chemist by trade, and I've just been hired on by a rather large biotech company doing something I never thought I would do, and I'm learning a lot about the lengths that these companies go to get a drug to market.
Mm-hmm.
And how every little thing is documented. Like, I spent my first 2+ weeks working just in training, getting all this GMP, this good manufacturing practices training, reading all these standard operating procedures and being tested on everything. And it occurred to me while I was going through this that if we, this is all mandated by the FDA, and if the FDA can mandate a large company like the one I'm working for to do all this stuff, then why can't we do the same for these voting machines, vote counters?
Sure.
You know, I mean, I've worked as a chemist for, probably about 18 years, and I've always kept really, pristine notebooks, and I've always kept really good records of everything, but this is totally, it's totally blown my mind as far as, like, I'm used to drawing my sevens with a line through the middle of them.
I do the same thing.
And I can't do that anymore.
Those are illegal now.
Because it looks like I tried to cross it out. And so if I do that, I have to cross the whole line out, initial it, write an explanation, and then rewrite what, you know, rewrite the seven, or, you know, the whole line with the seven without the line through it.
Oh, mercy.
Or the form gets sent back to me by the people in quality assurance saying, you know, you put this line through your seven, that's not acceptable.
To be fair, that would wreak havoc with a pharmaceutical firm in, say, France or Germany.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But I just, I don't know. It got me thinking, why can't the FEC mandate this type of record keeping and proving?
Absolutely. Under the same sort of consideration, Pat, imagine that there are plenty of computers, I'm sure, in use in what it is that you're doing. And I'm sure that there are standards and practices with regard to those computers.
Yeah, well, I have this week coming up, I have three classes I have to take on just checking the samples through the computers, because they track the samples every step of the way.
Now, imagine that in the election machine business, states buy election machines, and the election machine companies tell the states, oh, we're sorry, you can't see the source code.
Right, well, exactly, that's what I'm saying. I mean,
and maybe part of this, and it's a doctrine, I think it's called the doctrine of preemption, if I recall it correctly, that says, as a function of the federal constitution and the dynamic between the states and the federal government, that the states get to make their own various and sundry separate laws, unless it's an issue that the federal government has determined to preempt and thereby make a standardized uniform law. And there are hence federal laws versus state laws. With that being the case, the biggest problem, and perhaps a partial answer to the question you pose, is the fact that each individual state is still responsible for its individual election laws. And maybe what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, and I tend to concur in this, is that it is time that the federal government preempted the business of elections.
So that
we have a standardization of elections and election processes and procedures, and an election in Maine looks just like an election in Arizona, looks just like an election in Idaho, looks just like an election in Michigan.
Right, or at least have the machines or whatever process is in place be open to auditing, by the candidates that are affected, by the people that are affected, I don't know. I guess the FDA could come in to any company that does manufacturing a drug and ask to see the books,
Mm-hmm.
And, they can't say, well, we're sorry, this is proprietary information.
Imagine if the FDA showed up at some pharmaceutical firm and said, we want to see the recipe, or we want to see how you go about cooking the recipe, and the pharmaceutical company said, well, we're sorry, that's a secret, and the FDA is then going to release that drug to be used in the American population? I don't think so. But that's exactly what we allow to happen with the I call them voter regulation machines.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that. I think that our vote is, as important as, it might not directly affect someone as much as, a drug, but I think, you know, in the big picture, yeah, they're as important as the process that makes a drug is as important as the process that we have when we, you know, cast our vote and when our votes are counted.
I couldn't agree more. So do you feel like it's working out well? Do you like what you're doing?
I'm still getting used to the second shift.
Now, when you say second shift, Pat, are you talking about 4 to 12?
No, they're 10-hour days, so it's 2 to 12:30.
Oh, so 2 in the morning to 12:30 noon?
No, 2 in the afternoon till 12:30 at night.
Can I just offer up a little something, and I'm not trying to be a downer. I don't know if you'll ever get used to that shift. My father, rest his soul, in his years as a furnace foreman and a furnace operator, he worked what they called rotating shifts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was even worse, because one week he was 8 to 4, the next week he was 4 to 12, and the week after that he was 12 to 8. Or maybe it was 2 weeks on or whatever.
Yeah.
And you'd think he would have hated the graveyard shift the most. But he hated the 4 to 12 more than anything else, because he said there was no way to make your day be anything but busted up into a million pieces. So, I don't know how much getting used to it there is. Getting accustomed to it may be the better word.
Yeah. Well, it's, I don't know, it's kind of interesting because, you know, it's basically a 4-day work week, but they're like rotating weekends. So, like, I have my whole schedule for the next calendar year, like, you know, if I stay the same shift, you know, the second shift is broken up into two teams, the A team and the B team. So if I stay on the B team for the rest of the year, then I have my schedule for the rest of the year, and I can, you know, plan weekly, you know, the time that I'll be able to spend with my kids, and you know, if we're gonna, there's usually like a 3-day stretch in there where I don't have to work at all, and so if we're gonna, you know, go down to the folks or anything like that, I can plan that way, and the thing I think that's amazed me the most is, I used to not be able to sleep past, you know, 6 o'clock when my boys woke up. There was no hiding my head under the covers and grabbing an extra 15, 20 minutes. But it's amazing when you get home at 12, or when you get home at 1:15, 1:30, and you don't really get unwound and get into bed until 3, how much noise you can actually sleep through.
Well, there's some truth in that, of course. By the same token, you just touched on so much reality, insofar as it's that unwind factor. Because what you're telling people is that your 12:30 at night has become most folks 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So your bed, technically, you know, you are wound up. No matter what it was, you know, if your job is the proofreader of the telephone book, and you get off at 12:30 at night, you still have to wind down.
Yeah.
And that's where the challenge comes. So have the boys acclimated to it and stuff?
I think they're getting more used to it. The first week was definitely hard for them. The first week of my second shift, because the first week that I was hired, I went in regular first shift to get all of the very general kind of training that all the employees get, and so they only do that during the day. They don't do that for second shift. But when I started on the second shift, it got a little difficult for the boys, yeah. But I think they're getting the hang of it now. And we definitely enjoy having, you know, the 3-day weekends and stuff. Although, you know, they were used to, you know, I was laid off for almost 5 months. So they were used to having me around all the time.
Yeah.
And, so that was probably as big an adjustment as just the second shift thing.
Well, we were all proud to hear when you got the thing, and I have no doubt, Pat, that you will succeed, and dramatically so, at this. I just we'll keep our fingers crossed for you getting acclimated to that weird little chunk of the day.
Yeah. I never thought I would be doing the corporate thing. You know, I mean, all chemistry, you're working for, bigger companies, but, I never thought I would go back. One of my first experiences out of school working was I worked 3 years at Pfizer, and I was miserable. I hated it, and I swore to my wife I would never go back there. And I didn't go back to Pfizer, but, it's a similar sort of company. I'm kind of amazed that I haven't been there. I guess, I'm working on a really cool project, and I think that helps.
Good people?
Yeah.
If you can stand the people you're working around, that's really a big part of being able to stand the whole process.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I
wanted to check into them on the end of my 3-day weekend, and my wife and the boys are down in the Cape still, and so I had an opportunity to call.
I'm so glad you did, and give our best to your wife and the boys. Agnes asked me about you just the other day, and it's like family around here. So I'm very, very glad that you called, and chime in anytime. And I like the fact that you're looking at what you're seeing and bringing it back to something that we could all consider in terms of what we do and what we don't do with this business of We the People.
Yeah.
Well, Pat, take care, and again, don't be a stranger, please.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Bye now. That's Pat. If you know him from the chat room, you know him as Twin Dad. One of these days, I'll get a picture of those little guys. I'll put them on the wall in the new studio. And by the way, before I do go back to the next phone call, Rick Goodner, horn psychotherapist. If you were listening to Rick's Place this weekend, you heard him up the ante. And Billy Shears of Night Sounds reminded me to remind you of this. He truly has upped the ante. You know, all this month, Rick has said that he would match dollar for dollar in terms of creating the new studio building fund. What you contribute in terms of just keeping the lights on here, he will match dollar for dollar. Well, Rick and I had a little talk about where the funding was this month, and so Rick decided to up the ante. And he says now that he's going to go 2-for-1. 2-for-1. To try to get the horn into new digs and make us a little bit better able to bring you to bring you the stuff that you've become accustomed to, and maybe expand some things, make them better, take the move into video like we've been talking about. So the offer stands now, per Rick of Rick's Place. 2-for-1. Make it happen in January, and he will match dollar for dollar for dollar. So please be advised. And I just totaled things up, just so you'll know. And as of today, thanks to a number of people. And if you want your name mentioned, let me know. Otherwise, I assume you wish to remain anonymous. But thanks to a handful of people over the weekend and today, we crossed the $1,000 threshold. We're now at $1,200 for the month. And if you recall, we're trying to reach $3,000. And we've got 3 days to do it in. What's the line from the song from Smokey and the Bandit? Got a long way to go and a short time to get there. Yeah. I do have a face for radio. I'm not crazy to get, but I'm crazy to build audience here. I'm crazy. I'm absolutely obsessed with the idea of expanding the dialogue and the discussion. That's why all of this happens. That's why the 18-hour days, that kind of thing. So thank you to everybody who have done your part during the month of January. You have no idea how we appreciate it, and you have no idea how exciting it's going to be to get started on the new studio. And let's go to the phones, see who we've got. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
Hey, David.
Well, today was a eventful day for me. Not that you'd be so much interested or excited in it, but Ron Paul actually came in my city.
Oh, did he? Did you go see him?
I actually went to go see him, and what he said to me made a lot of sense, and I saw all the people from Maine come across to my city, and then I realized that someone's not telling someone something else, and what he said, a lot of I kept asking myself, would Edwards say this? No. Would Hillary say this? No. Would Obama say this? No. And I just kept naming all the candidates, and no, they wouldn't say it. When he got on the issue of Jose Padilla, he stood up and said, that's an atrocity. Why would giving this guy 17 years? You might have a lot of big differences
I don't have a difference with him on that.
I know, but what I'm saying is, the big issues that matter to me, what he's saying at that moment, and in that time, that's what people needed to hear. Someone who were like, yes, that is, why did that happen? Or just to give that kind of click in their head. And I talked to a lot of people, and I did a lot of interviews for the Ron Paul radio station, just on the fly, and I just told them to say a few words and why you support Ron, and I got a whole bunch of answers why. And it really comes down to, if you're going to support the war and you're going to support the military complex and you're going to support all this, you're going to lose it all. And that's really what's happened to the Democratic Party. You just they supported everything, and they say, "Well, we're going to get this. We're going to get this in return." And no, we're not. And as far as you were saying about voting for Hillary, you know, that's a psychological what would you call it? A psychological deception, I think, in a lot of ways. More so like a psyop, because you're saying you have to vote this way. You have to vote this way. No, you don't. Not if you're not in a key state. Because that's all that really matters, Bob, when it comes down to key states. As far as I'm concerned, I can vote for the Hanna-Barbera Party, and I won't even be concerned about it, because I know in the end it's not matter.
Are you talking about in a primary?
No, I'm talking about any party for president in terms of where I am. Because I know my vote during that time period, if there's nobody I want anyways, what does it matter? It doesn't. And it's not a key state either. Maine has never been a key state. You name me one election. Name me one presidential election where Maine is a key state.
I can't do that, but I can provide you some right close.
No, but Bob, what I'm saying.
No, wait. Work with me here, David.
Yeah.
All right. I can't provide you Maine, but I know that you've got two senators.
Yeah.
So that's two electoral college votes. How many members of Congress do you have?
I'm not really sure on that.
Okay. Well, let me compare that with West Virginia, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I got two senators. I got three members of Congress. That means we got five electoral college votes. In the year 2000, when the Republicans sent Charlton Heston to the Raleigh County Armory in Beckley, West Virginia, to stir up the mouth breathers and the knuckle walkers by saying, Al Gore's going to get your guns. And they sat there and they hoorahed like the bunch of idiotic rednecks that they were. And man, they didn't walk. They ran to the polls to vote for George W. Bush so they could keep their guns. All right?
Mm-hmm.
George Bush carried West Virginia for the first time that a Republican had carried West Virginia since God was a baby. Okay? We didn't even vote for Reagan. We went for Dukakis. All right? Those five electoral votes, had West Virginia done the sane thing, had West Virginia done the economically prudent thing, and voted for Al Gore, Florida in 2000 would not have mattered. There's no such thing as a small state whose votes don't matter. Five electoral college votes in West Virginia would have made Al Gore undeniably the president of the United States, and the Supreme Court couldn't have done anything about it, and that thuggish mob in South Florida couldn't have done anything about it. But we didn't. We acted like a bunch of dirt, ignorant, knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing, maggot-eating rednecks. And it mattered. And there are the issue that's close and near and dear to my heart. It has meant the destruction of hundreds of thousands of square acres of our mountains that weren't being destroyed and couldn't be destroyed before George Bush got into office, David. There are no small states.
But seriously, do you think that...
You think I wasn't serious?
No. Well, what I'm saying is, it's an expression.
Oh, okay. I mean, I'm not kidding here.
I know. But what I'm saying is that those mountaintops, everything that you're fighting for, seriously, do you think any of your candidates, they're going to give a damn about that? If the corporations keep asking, God, we got to do this, after a while, they're just going to give in. And that's eventually what's going to happen to any place.
I know that with Giuliani, Romney, McCain, who am I missing? Huckabee and Paul, that all the crying and begging in the world is not going to stop them from blowing up these mountains. Okay? I know that Ron Paul is as pure a corporatist as exists because he is at his fundament a libertarian. Now, on the other hand, I know that, for instance, under the Clinton administration and the enforcement of the Clean Water Act, that we had vastly less mountaintop removal. I also know that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama have heard the siren song of clean coal and heard the siren song of liquid coal technology. But I also know that because they are Democrats, they are prone to at least sit and give a listen to people in organizations like the Rainforest Action Network and the Sierra Club and the Coal River Mountain Watch and the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition and the Highlands Conservancy. I know that they will sit down and give a listen. So for me, the choice is easy on that issue. What I try not to be, however, David, is a single-issue voter.
Hmm. Do you think that there's a difference between Hillary and McCain, really?
I absolutely do.
You do?
Yeah, because I know what McCain's voting record is, and it is different from Hillary's. McCain is different. Hillary's better on the environment. Hillary is better on children's issues.
Uh-huh.
Hillary is better, frankly, although it's a lot closer comparison, on the war. Hillary has made it clear that she wants an end to the war. John McCain just recently said it would be okay by him if we're in Iraq for another 100 years. That has a direct impact on my hope of having progeny that'll carry my name forward, because 100-year Iraq war will sooner or later kill somebody in my future.
You don't think Hillary will start another war? Is that what you're trying to say?
I don't. No. Do I think she's going to go to war with Iran? No, I do not think she's going to go to a war with Iran.
If that's the only remains you have of your economy, do you think that they're just going to pull off and say, "Well, that's it. We're going to call it a day."
Look, you got
to. That's what.
No. Yeah,
on.
But look, you got to build bombs for your military, whether you use them or not. and they don't stay good forever, so you got to keep building them. The military-industrial complex is not going to collapse because we're not at war with Iraq or Iran or anybody else.
I know, but what I'm saying is it's like a heroin addict. You just gave him, you gave him another fix. They're mainlining this stuff right now. They're not going to stop, even though...
Right, but, it, but, the, th- but the thing is, David, it's crippling us.
Right.
Okay.
So my thing is when you put, and when we put Hillary in office, and it, when it comes to go to war with another country, and this economy is about to collapse, that's what I mean, is there's going to be no difference between McCain and Hillary on that. That's what I mean.
I disagree. I don't think that Hillary will be more likely to go to war than John McCain. I think the exact opposite is true. I think John McCain, being a military man in the first place and someone who had no compunction about bombing the thatched roof huts of little brown peasants from 40,000 feet, I don't think he'll have the compunction against doing it to some other group of brown people.
I tend to think that Hillary and everything that has happened thus far in her career, it's all the biggest sham the world has ever seen. And let's not forget that she's really close friends with McCain, so if they do run against each other, I'm just going to be laughing because it's obviously going to be theater. More theater than usual. Because pretty much I would say that they're accustomed to their lifestyles, and they're accustomed to keep it by any means necessary, as long as they don't see it, Bob.
But consider, David, please consider, it's about who you hang out with, too. All right?
Who did she hang out with?
So we know that John McCain is going to hang out with the American Enterprise Institute. We know that he's going to hang out with the Heritage Foundation. And so when it comes time to appoint a Supreme Court justice, we know who he's going to pick up the phone and say, you know, hey, what, you know, who do you suggest? Give me my short list. And that short list is going to be comprised of weird, just weirdo acid, like they're on acid, just, you know, whacked out of their brains, right wing, so-called originalist, original constitutionalist, original constructionist freaks, just like out of the same mold as Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas, and, you know, they say Kennedy's a moderate. Well, you know, if Kennedy was a moderate, we wouldn't have who we've got in the White House right now. So
you know how you can tell that Hillary is going to veer this country into a police state if she does get in office? The way she handled the protesters, the way any of these candidates handle the protesters. If they can't take someone in the audience, that to me is a sure sign that when they get in power, they're going to mess everything up to the hilt. If you can't handle protesters, you're done for as far as I'm concerned. You're not getting my vote.
And yet, to her credit, when she was campaigning in New Hampshire, God knows you'd never see a protester screaming at George Bush to go and iron my shirt. But there the hecklers were, and they were permitted to heckle. If you watch the YouTube clips, there's been no shortage of hecklers at Hillary or Bill Clinton events, and you know, they haven't been tasered and they haven't been dragged off in chains like they were under the Bush administration.
So you think just by not being aggressive with them yet, but taking them out and not having them say their piece and just basically making them look like erratic nuts, you think that's going to be the viable choice for... What I'm saying is they're hanging around the same people. And you can say, well, she doesn't support the American Heritage Foundation. That might be. But she's having dinner with the same people. She's hanging out with them. She's probably golfing with them. Probably power lunching, all of that. It really comes down to...
Well, to that extent, they're all part of the Washington culture, and it is all incestuous, and they do all run across each other.
That's right, and that's why...
And guess who else is part of the Washington culture? A certain little congressman from Texas.
He also gives back his money, and he's probably the only congressman who does that, by the way. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah, I was aware of that.
Money.
Good.
Well, what I'm saying is there's more to somebody just because you don't agree on certain issues.
No, no, no. I know there's a lot to Ron Paul.
Yeah.
I agree with him on the war. I agree with him about the war for entirely different reasons, and I think my reasons are far more moral than his are. You know, he doesn't want to make war on brown people because brown people aren't worth making war on. I don't want to make war. I want to not make war on brown people because it's wrong to make war with people who aren't making war on you. No, I know. I am well versed in Ron Paul. I know the way that he bows and scrapes to corporate America. I know that when nobody else in the world was saying that George Bush's idea of piratizing Social Security was a good one, that he was out there saying, yes, it is. I know that he doesn't believe that a woman has a right to control what goes on in her own insides. I know lots about Ron Paul.
His idea on Social Security wasn't that. His idea was, see, this is the problem people don't want to talk about. His idea of Social Security was they should always have the option. The idea to close out the gate on the people in general is the worst decision, because you do that, you give more power to the system structure, and you keep doing it. And that's really what's happening with the Democratic Party, Bob, and that's really why we're at in terms of, well, we need this, we need this, and if we have this choice, we won't get this anymore. And that's what...
But David, do you understand that Ron Paul, everything that's come out of his mouth was said by Southern politicians before the Civil War? I'm not kidding. It's all the same old stuff.
A lot of people say the same stuff. All of your heroes in politics, Bob, have said the same stuff. Nothing is new under the sun. We know that. But what I'm saying is I'd rather have someone say what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling on pretty much all of the political and foreign policy issues than all of the social and moral issues, because to me that's all BS. And here's what's going to happen: you're going to give them everything. We're going to give everything to. This is what's going to happen: we'll give everything to the government, and pretty soon we'll be in gated communities. Because I remember when you try to say something where you say, it's like what you were saying about, oh, I fear this and I fear that and I fear this person. Well, the more you fear that person, the more you veer off to this side, and before you know it, they gate you in there.
I'm not going to vote out of fear, David. I'm going to vote for the Democratic nominee for the presidency, because I believe in the basic principles that are enunciated by the Democratic Party. All right? I don't believe that corporate America is our solution. I don't believe that a woman doesn't have the right to make her own medical decisions. I do believe that it is absolutely necessary for this society to function that our middle class be viable. You see, libertarianism drives you toward a two-class society of the very rich and the very poor. It's dope-smoking corporatism is what it is. It really, really is, because, you know, if you stumble and fall, well, government, you know, there's not going to be any government there to help you. You're going to have to pick yourself up by your own bootstraps, even if some rapacious libertarian has come along and stolen your damn boots. That's libertarianism. That's Ron Paul. This idea that the Constitution exists in some sort of a vacuum, whereby if it wasn't enunciated in the late 18th century, it can't possibly be contemplated in the early 21st, is nuts. It's just crazy. And of course, there's a whole lot of Ron Paul that comes smack dab out of Ayn Rand. Who was just, whoo, you know, I mean, you know, go get the decon crazy.
Well, Bob, I have to say, every single theory of society is crazy on the surface, especially when you total in the figures of the current population of what we're at now. And really what I'm getting at is the things that you want the most for your family and the things that everybody wants for their family. That's really gone now. And there's not going to be a middle class with the, like I said, there's not going to be a middle class with the current population and the current economy we have and the current decisions that everyone keeps making. There's going to have to be really, really tough choices. And that, and really what that has to do with is just, like I said, if people keep voting the Democrat and the Republican ticket, we might as well flush this country down.
Ticket do you want them to vote?
I'm telling you, there needs to be something, there needs to be a serious change. You know when someone said, what was it, Chris, he said you need to shut it all down or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what needs to happen. The whole system needs to collapse.
And then we just try to rise from the ashes, or we just start gunning?
Basically, it's gonna happen eventually. Would you rather have it in the future or now?
If it's going to happen eventually,
yeah.
You've just told me it's going to happen in the future.
That's right. Would you rather have it happen in the present or just be waiting for it and not knowing what day it is or whatever?
I don't think any... What's it say in the book? No man knows the hour or the time or the hour or the date. We don't know when it's going to happen. We know that societies evolve. If we're talking about societal evolution, you know, it's going on even as we speak.
The middle class in America was a temporary thing, and people need to realize that. It was.
Well, then you have to say that the middle class around the world is a temporary thing.
That's right. It is. It's all designed to.
So we just say screw it and go back and give up, and wait for the more predatory among us to eat us and become chiefs, and wait for our turn to become dirt digging serfs.
We go back to zero. That's really what happens.
It never goes back to zero.
Yes, everything goes back to zero. In terms of civilizations, they crumble and they fall. And we go back to zero and we start under the system, and then that falls. That's how it works.
It really isn't. Every society, David, comes out of what went before it. All right? The only clear societally evolutionary demarcation exists in the crossing point between hunter-gatherer and sedentary agrarian society. Okay? Because beyond that, every sedentary agrarian society builds on or grows from the foundation established by the one before it. Let's see. Let's start with the Fertile Crescent. And it's Sumer, Akkad, Babylon, Assyria, and eventually you wind up with you wind up in Iraq. Okay, Rome. Rome was said to have fallen, but like I've said before, they never hung up a sign saying the empire has now collapsed. When Charlemagne, who complained that he had spent too many years with a sword in his hand to be able to learn to write, consolidated the Frankish powers and became, you know, Uber King, he was called the Holy Roman Emperor because they considered themselves the legitimate successors to the Roman Empire. And the same thing can be said with the dynastic changes, one to the other, in China. It can also be said with the changes in India. We think of ancient Egypt as some sort of long-lasting, you know, monolith, but it wasn't. There's the New Kingdom, the Old Kingdom, the 18th Dynasty, the 13th Dynasty, and they're not the same thing. It's a constant state of one society growing into another. So there's not going to be a whole, you know, it's not going to turn into, I don't think, Mad Max world. It may happen in isolated places, but there's not going to be a global, and, you know, for the Kevin Costner fans, it ain't going to be Water World either. But what you'll find is humans using their talent for adaptation, because that's the only thing that's gotten us where we are so far. We don't have claws like bears and lions. We can't swim like dolphins. We don't have the noses of dogs or the night vision of a raccoon. All we have is bipedalism and a big brain. And that's the only thing that's allowed us to survive for the last 2.5 million years. It's the only thing that stands between us and the cockroaches. Well, you know, that and an opposable thumb.
Well, I think everything has a close to a curtain. And it's not, like I said,
I'm trying to understand here. So you're hoping that Ron Paul is somehow going to be not the agent of change, but rather the agent of collapse?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying he's never going to be president, but he got to say a lot of what he said on the debates. He said what he wanted to say about the Federal Reserve System on Jay Leno. He said all of that, and to me, that's what was really important. Somebody said that. John Edwards wouldn't say it. John Edwards would just smile on TV and laugh and say he really cares about people. And after a while, you're like, okay, what does that really mean? And I mean, my point is eventually someone has to look at the real issues that people are afraid to look at and say them, no matter what the consequences is. If you're labeled a nut or you're labeled the fringe or whatever. And it doesn't really matter what someone's ideology is either. All that matters, really, is what that inspires in someone and motivates them to do for the time being that they're there. That's really all that matters.
Okay. I'm struggling here, David. I confess, I'm struggling.
Yeah.
Because, for instance, to say, well, you know, John Edwards says he cares about poor people, but does he really?
I mean, what I mean is when you're vague, and believe me, Edwards and all of those candidates, I listen to them, Bob.
The guy's got the least vague of the three health care plans.
A health care plan.
Yes, a health care plan.
And how are we going to pay for that, by the way? See, this is what I'm talking about.
Well, okay, David, how are we going to pay for that? I've seen that on a million Paul boards. How are we going to pay for it? We already spend the money it would take to do it. The only difference is that the money we spend on insurance right now only covers, it leaves about 47 million people out in the cold.
No, see, we don't spend the money. That just brings the debt to us.
No, we do spend the money. We do spend the money. In the form of insurance premiums. Businesses pay businesses pay a portion, and then individual members of the plan pay a portion. The only difference is that it doesn't get us anything that we need or want.
You would agree, though, if we're broke and we don't have any money to begin with, that's really just a moot point. I mean, we're just putting money out of nothing right now.
No, we're not.
Yes, we are. The Federal Reserve right now, the value of what you want to see, you're not allowed to see their books, by the way, and I don't think we'd ever have Edwards here talk about this. We're bound for this system to collapse right now. It is right now, a matter of fact. Did you see what happened in the markets in Asia Friday?
Yeah, and then I saw what happened on the Dow today.
Right.
You know, up 122 points. It is certainly a gamed system, David. But
let me ask you, do you think it's wrong to have a different kind of currency in this country? This is where I want to know where your head is at in terms of that. Because if you do, then to me that's authoritarianism. If you would just say, you want me to have this currency, and to me, because what they did when they raided the Liberty Dollar, they basically said that in effect, that this is the only currency we're going to use, because that's how afraid they were. And by the way, the Liberty Dollar is like,
you know, the
I don't know how much more value than the dollar.
I got to stop saying, you know, I've been castigated by mail for saying that. Every once in a while, you'll pick up a newspaper,
mm-hmm.
and you'll find a story of somebody who was going through somebody's attic in Busted Knuckle, Alabama, and found old great-great multi-great-great-granddad's stash of Confederate money. Well, there's a different currency. It has antique value, but no monetary value.
No, but what I'm saying is people should be allowed to use that when they want to for a currency. There shouldn't just be one form of currency, as in the dollar. This is it. And if it's basically valued at nothing, that's basically what I'm getting at.
Fiat currency is based upon the goodwill of the people exchanging it. So yeah, as long as the dollar will buy what the merchant is offering, the dollar is good.
I know, but what I'm saying is, see, this is where it gets to the authoritarian issue. If certain people, this is a serious thing.
There are David, there are island tribes that have used puka shells for currency.
The ancient Mexica
used cacao beans.
No, listen.
And it was all fiat.
When people want to use currency for themselves, do you think it's right? This is what I want to ask you. Do you think it's right that they bust them up and then they're going to arrest them because they want to use a different currency?
Do you know where this argument comes from, David?
Where?
Straight out of Atlas Shrugged. And it's the John Galt solid gold dollar.
No, I'm not talking about solid gold. I'm talking about a different currency. If a certain circle of people want to use it, and they're in the United States, should they be arrested for using it? That's what I'm asking.
If they're trying to use it outside their circle, yeah, sure, because counterfeiting the currency is illegal.
No, they weren't, and they still got busted for it.
Are you talking about those right wing Idaho the fraud crowd?
No, I'm not talking about right wing or left wing or any of that. I'm telling you that if certain people want to use the currency, do you think it's right that people should be threatened and saying, hey,
who's being threatened?
You're gonna use a dollar.
Who's being threatened? You know, I've got friends across the river. A guy comes in and eats breakfast in a restaurant, and then he trades them out in goods and services that he provides. It's called barter. Nobody's threatening or arresting them.
The Liberty Dollar, the people who are trying to get that currency out there and spread it and circulate it, when they got busted by the feds, they in fact put the reins down and said, you guys can't trade. In fact, they were
counterfeiting the currency. You couldn't do it in ancient Rome. You couldn't do it in Great Britain. You couldn't do it in the ancient example, the cacao beans in ancient Mexico. You couldn't carve dark little pieces of wood to look like cacao beans because it.
So, Bob, what is a printing press? When you're putting money in.
David, my friend, listen.
Yeah.
I know that you've really gone deep into Ron Paul world. Because
no,
if you've
gone deep into Ron Paul world.
Yeah, if you're talking about these currency issues, you have. Okay?
Yeah.
Because when you start when you move into that stuff, then you're and I'm not being mean to you. Please understand, cuz I'm not and I won't. But when you move into the realm of the Liberty Dollar, you have gone way down. You've gone way down the rabbit hole into libertarian land.
No, Bob, I don't. But, I'm not a libertarian. I don't agree with all the tenets of that. What I'm saying is,
well, no, to be a libertarian, you don't have to agree with all their tenets. I don't agree with all the tenets of the Democratic Party, David.
You just stated my case when you said you can't counterfeit money. That's in essence what the Federal Reserve is doing right now with the printing press.
No, they're not.
They don't have the money.
No, they're not, because there is a structure of laws behind it. We pay out on treasury bonds. That's how we hang bad paper all over Asia.
Bob, did you watch From Freedom to Fascism, by the way?
Yes, I did.
And what did you think of it?
I'd heard a lot of it before,
You didn't think there were any valid points to that. That's what I mean.
I didn't say there weren't any valid points. I said I'd heard it all before.
Yeah, I know, but if it's more based in fact than it was before, what does that tell you? That's what I'm saying.
That's what I'm trying to say. I've heard it before. A lot of it is historically and intellectually invalid. It is not what it says it is in the film.
Do you think they should be investigated? Like everyone else? Bob, they don't have their records open. You know that, don't you? From the film and the interviews they've had, you can't look at their records. They're one of the only organizations that does that. The IRS is another one. And the MPA is the third one. Now, if you really believe that, then we're not living in what I would call a tolerable society to have those organizations. You say, don't touch it. You ever notice that none of the politicians talk about it? Why do you think that is?
Because
they're afraid, Bob.
No, they're not afraid. No, they're
okay,
not afraid.
Then why?
Because most people aren't. Why do we have these candidate pageants where we don't talk about what matters? Why do we talk about race instead of talking about what's happening to the races, whether they be white, red, green, blue, or black? Because the American people don't have the temperament for it. That's why we can talk about this on this program, but it probably doesn't get talked about in a lot of others.
I got to tell you, Bob, the Federal Reserve System, before I go, biggest elephant in the room. The fact that you can't
The Federal Reserve System is a system that was designed and put in place to try to stop the boom and bust nature of a capitalist economy. Okay?
And isn't that funny that they're the ones capitalizing from it all?
There? How many rich people are there in the country? Go get hold of Free Lunch by David K. Johnston and read. The rich are, the plain rich, not the super rich. The plain rich are getting screwed in this country, too. All right? They is all a function of who one conveniently wishes to qualify and as being the they.
Bob, when you have an organization, all I have to say is this. When you have an organization that isn't investigated, you and I both know there's something going on. I'll say it again. Three investigations.
I don't think the chairman of the Fed should serve fixed terms like he does.
That gives him a
level of power that to make or break presidencies.
Yeah.
I seem to recall Alan Greenspan being begged to take action in 2000. Oh no, I can't do that. It's an election year. But by God, it's an election year in 2008, and the Fed is scrambling to prop up George Bush's dead ass. All right? And that's because most of your Fed... Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan sat lovingly at the knee of Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand was a hardcore libertarian. Ayn Rand invented most of the so-called conservative agenda in this country.
Actually, they would call her more of an objectivist, but...
Well, no, that's what she called herself. I know the history. And she had a falling out with the libertarians, and that's what they do. They fall out all the time. That's why they're not a legitimate political party, because all they want to do is sit around and piss and moan and bitch and jack off in the corner instead of learning how to govern. Ooh, that was harsh.
Is this really governing, Bob, where we've gotten... Seriously,
it depends on how it depends. We're running out of time, David, but it depends on how you define it. If you define government as trying to do the greatest amount of good for the greatest number of people, no, we're not. If however you define government as trying to keep a sort of stasis in society that keeps society from blowing up like societies tend to do, as you've pointed out, yeah, we're doing okay.
Well,
I got to go, David. We're out of time.
All right.
All right.
Later.
Bye. And a quick reminder, the offer is up to 2-for-1, $2 for every dollar you contribute to keep the horns lights on. Rick Goodner contributes $2 toward the building program. I hope you'll take that into consideration as January moves to a close. Thanks to everybody. Peter Godbold will not be along with a live show tonight because Peter Godbold is a man without a voice. John Fox won't be with us tonight because John Fox is a man without an internet. I won't do the horn section tonight because I will probably be entirely voiceless myself from screaming at the jug-eared, pig-eyed, hateful little vile lout as he makes his final State of the Union address. We all square? Cool. So thanks, everybody. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch. See you.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 112 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome indeed to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on the listener-supported Head-On Radio Network, also brought to you by Coal River Mountain Watch. That's CRMW.net. And speaking of Coal River Mountain Watch, our good friend whom we missed terribly boarded a plane yesterday in West Virginia and took off to go to Massachusetts, which is Mr. Bob Kincaid. There was all some concern on whether I guess all of the hosts are on the no-fly list, but in any case, they let Bob get on the plane and head off to Massachusetts. Bob is in a meeting being held at Williams College in Massachusetts. It's called Focus on the Nation. It's partly referencing Coal River Mountain Watch, environmentalism, and economic justice regarding mountaintop removal and another other subjects. And I was just distracted. There we go. Yes, doggy's fine. I think nice doggy. It's the first time she's ever come over to say hi at the beginning of a program. In any case, we expect Bob back Thursday. He'll be back Thursday evening. And so let's get on with this show. And let's see, where are we headed? Yes, here we go. Regarding the listener-supported network, we appreciate the support of Coal River Mountain Watch. And also we appreciate your support, too. If you can stop by headonradionetwork.com, you'll find a link there to the PayPal button. We are in the process of fundraising not only to keep the stream streaming and the packets packing. We are also in the process of fundraising for a new studio to be built, construction. The network is growing, and many things are planned. We are also in discussion regarding attending the Democratic National Convention, our committee, rather, in, let's see, that would be in Denver. I believe that's during the month of August. A number of us are talking about going up there to do live broadcasting, our live streaming audio from the convention. Certainly something exciting and something new for the network. We have hosts far-flung. If you're new to the network, you may not realize we have hosts in everywhere from Australia to Washington, D.C., to you name it. We're spread out all over the planet. So it's in line with something that this network can do. Remote locations are not unusual to us whatsoever. Example, I'm in Tallahassee. The studio is in West Virginia. That being the case, we know all about remote hookups, and that's our forte. So what better network to give you the progressive point of view than the Head-On Radio Network? Of course, I'll be bringing the LGBT point of view when we do that in August, which is currently a goal. Of course, thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Monday, February the 4th, 2008. The show site is Strictly Confidential Radio.